You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the June 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to you, our listeners. There remains a range of opinions about who was behind the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon 15 years ago this September 11th. There should be little doubt, however, that it was America's response to that day's events that has been the driving force in producing the unprecedented destabilization, terror, and carnage that have engulfed the Middle East and Southeast Asia, producing the proliferation of jihadist groups and the flow of refugees into Europe, none of which shows any signs of abating. And yet, if you listen to our president or to our national media, you get no sense that this global catastrophe is America's doing, our contribution to the 21st century, and hence no thought of holding anyone accountable. One would say, ironically, if it had been predictable, that it was Barack Obama, elected to presidency on the basis of his opposition to the Iraq War, who put the brakes on any effort to hold the guilty parties accountable by declaring that we, as a nation, must look forward and not backward. In so doing, he was extending a pardon to one of the most vicious cast of characters to ever appear on the American political scene. And the anti-war movement, entranced by the notion of America having elected the first black president, let him get away with it. And then it vanished. Well, not everyone in the anti-war movement did so. One, Rebecca Gordon, who with her partner Jan Adams began publishing a bilingual journal, War Times, shortly after the invasion of Iraq, has recently published a call for war crimes trials for 22 individuals who are most responsible for launching the war in Iraq. It's called America Nuremberg, the U.S. officials who should stand trial for post-9/11 war crimes. And I'll be speaking with Rebecca about it at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. When is a terrorist not a terrorist? Well, apparently for the Western media, when the killer or killers are not Muslim. Last week, Joe Cox, a member of the British Parliament from the Labour Party, was shot and stabbed to death by a man known for his connections with neo-Nazis in the UK and the United States. It was clearly a terrorist act. Yet nowhere in our mainstream media, as it was with the murders of 9 members of the Emmanuel African Methodist Church, Episcopal Church in Charleston by white supremacist Dylan Roof a year ago last Friday, did we hear or see any mention of the word terror. From the point of view of the victims, as it was a week ago Sunday in Orlando, it was an act of sheer terror, and would have been that in the latter instance even had Omar Mateen not made a last-minute attempt to link his homicidal spree to ISIS. Joe Cox's murder temporarily halted the campaigning for tomorrow's crucial vote, in which British voters will decide whether or not their country will remain in the European Union. The decision whether to stay or go has split the major parties down the middle, with the murdered Joe Cox from Labour having sided earlier with Prime Minister David Cameron in support of staying within the EU, fearing an economic blowback if the voters choose to leave. In You Can't Make This Up department, Cameron made a last-minute appeal to British Jews, telling a Jewish audience that Britain can only positively affect Europe's approach to Israel by remaining in the European Union. Speaking Monday night to a Jewish health and social services charity, Cameron asked rhetorically, "When Europe is discussing its attitude to Israel, do you want Britain, Israel's greatest friend, in their opposing boycotts, opposing the campaign for divestment and sanctions, or do you want us outside the room, powerless to affect the discussion that takes place?" End quote. His remarks were widely distributed in Britain's Jewish press. The late Joe Cox, on the other hand, was a member of the Labour Party's Friends of Palestine, a fact that U.S. papers did not see fit to publish. Whatever the result, can anyone in this country imagine Americans being given the opportunity to vote on such a critical policy decision by a president of the United States, regardless of his or her political party? No, I didn't think so. It's happening in Britain because Cameron made a promise to have this referendum when he ran for re-election. As for holding Obama to his promises, well, that's another matter. However, Britain votes is not likely to affect its membership and key role in NATO, which just conducted its largest military exercise since the end of the Cold War. As a Business Insider described it, quote, after a stunning show of force, several NATO nations concluded Anaconda 16, an annual Polish-led multinational exercise. The purpose was to bring partner nations together to train, exercise, and integrate Polish forces into a joint multinational environment while simultaneously demonstrating NATO's defense capabilities. The exercise comprised of more than 31,000 troops, hailing from 24 different nations, including the U.S., Canada, U.K., Germany, Spain, Turkey, and Ukraine. Maneuvers included air assault, airborne, air defense, and amphibious operations. This event also comes at the heels of NATO's decision to deploy 4 multinational battalions to Poland and the Baltic states to boost defense, much to Russia's chagrin, end quote, that Business Insider said. And it all began with the U.S.-sponsored coup in Ukraine 2 years ago, orchestrated by Secretary of State Clinton's former press spokesperson and President Obama's appointed Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia, Victoria Nuland Kagan, wife of Project for a New American Century co-founder Robert Kagan, who had already given his endorsement to Clinton before Donald Trump had won the Republican nomination. Let me at this point say to those who may have heard this before from me, I repeat it because I think it's important and because you're not likely to read or hear it anywhere else. The present situation is being compared with the atmosphere that existed between the U.S. and heads of the NATO nations, then a much smaller alliance, during the Cold War. One of the things the two eras have in common is that fear of a Soviet invasion by the peoples of Western Europe then and of a Russian invasion today have been overblown. During the 60s and 70s, I lived in and visited Western Europe a number of times, including both sides of the Berlin Wall. I don't recall meeting a single soul who expressed either support for the USSR or fear of a Soviet invasion. At the end of the Cold War and following the Soviet Union's collapse, it turned out that the CIA had exaggerated Moscow's threat for domestic consumption in order to legitimize the reckless record spending of taxpayers' dollars on weapons to fight an enemy that presented no threat to the U.S., a fact our lawmakers knew quite well. It's the same today with regard to what we are told is the threat of Russian aggression. The Europeans aren't buying it, much to the frustration not only of the White House, but of its stable of warmongering journalists, exemplified by the New York Times' Stephen Erlinger. Quote, security concerns are as high now as they have been since the end of the Cold War, he writes. Anxieties have been heightened by Russian military offensives in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and a bombing campaign in Syria that has demonstrated Moscow's rapidly increasing capabilities. Lately, Russia has talked about the utility of tactical nuclear weapons, end quote. Well, I'm no fan of Putin. I should note that there has been nothing that can be described as a Russian military offensive in either Crimea or eastern Ukraine, and that Putin's statements regarding the use of tactical nuclear weapons may be seen as a response to Obama's promised $1 trillion investment in upgrading Washington's own nuclear stockpile. What bothers the New York Times' Erlinger is that, quote, despite the growing threats, many European countries still resist strong measures to strengthen NATO. Many remain reluctant to increase military spending despite past pledges made, I should interject, under U.S. pressure. Some, like Italy, he writes, are cutting back. France is reverting to its traditional skepticism, he writes, toward the alliance, which it sees as an instrument of American policy and an infringement on its sovereignty, end quote. The goal of the latest NATO Secretary General, former Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg, is to build, quote, the biggest reinforcement of collective defense since the end of the Cold War, end quote, which will require installing 4 combat battalions up to 1,000 soldiers each and NATO members on Russia's borders. It goes on. Well, Britain, Germany, and the United States have agreed to lead 1 battalion each to be filled out with soldiers from other NATO allies, to preserve the idea of multinational forces, writes Stephen Erlinger, leadership of the 4th is not yet in sight as the July 8th to 9th NATO summit rapidly approaches, end quote. While Douglas Luth, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, says, quote, the U.S. is not thinking about doing 2. It is planning to station another armed 5,000-person brigade in Europe, bringing the number of brigades up to 3, and pre-positioning heavy weapons like tanks and artillery, and that, said Luke, will require, quote, large sums for capital investment to build special new warehouses and infrastructure, end quote. According to an article in the current issue of Time, Of NATO's 28 members, only the U.S., Britain, Poland, Greece, and Estonia spend at least 2% of their GDP on weaponry, the alliance's baseline expectation. And in absolute terms, the U.S. spends nearly three times as much on weapons of war as the other 27 nations combined. Given that NATO's primary purpose is to defend Europe, not the U.S., writes Times' Ian Bremmer, it's not surprising that Americans are left to wonder why a wealthy country like Germany can't take responsibility for its own defense, end quote. That's actually a very fair question, assuming that a substantial number of Americans think about such changes, which outside of those who voted for Bernie Sanders is not at all evident. First, the German people have different spending priorities than do their American counterparts. They believe, it seems obvious, that guaranteed medical care and essentially free education are more useful objects for their tax money than $100 million jets and their equivalent in tanks and drones. Then, of course, with more independent media, they have developed a more nuanced view of the Russians than have most Americans, whose ignorance about faraway places is unsurpassed. A Pew Research Center poll, for example, reported by Stars and Stripes a year ago, when tensions between Moscow and the West were high, revealed that more than half the German public, as well as that of Italy and France, were not supporting the use of military force in response to a Russian attack on a NATO member, if such would take place. This was seen as exposing the fragility of the greatly expanded alliance's bedrock principle that an attack on one is an attack on all. This past Monday and Tuesday, New York Times ran a two-part series that was a painful Kafkaesque reminder of the Cold War, when the U.S. Air Force had B-52 bombers loaded with nuclear weapons over the skies of Europe 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with Russia as a potential target. Quote, alarms sounded on a United States Air Force base in Spain, and officers began packing all the low-ranking troops they could grab onto buses for a secret mission. End quote. So David Phillips' article in the New York Times begins. There were cooks, grocery clerks, and even musicians from the Air Force band. It was late winter night in 1966, and a fully loaded B-52 bomber on a Cold War nuclear patrol had collided with a refueling jet high over the Spanish coast, freeing four hydrogen bombs that went tumbling toward a farming village called Palomares, a patchwork of small fields and tile-roofed white houses in an out-of-the-way corner of Spain's rugged southern coast that had changed little since Roman times. The story that followed, and which comprised two full pages inside the paper, was so gripping and so important for what it revealed about our government, the military bureaucracy, and its ultimate contempt for those who serve in our armed forces and ordinary civilians in a foreign country, that I felt for sure it would be reported on NPR or The Takeaway. Since it wasn't, I'm going to tell you a small part of it, as it was told by David Phillips in a brilliant piece of reporting. It was one of the biggest nuclear accidents in history, and the United States wanted it cleaned up quickly and quietly, wrote Phillips. But if the men getting onto buses were told anything about the Air Force's plan for them to clean up spill radioactive material, it was usually, quote, don't worry. There was no talk about radiation or pollution, plutonium or anything else, said Frank Thompson, a then 22-year-old trombone player who spent days searching contaminated fields without protective equipment or even a change of clothes. They told us it was safe, and we were dumb enough, I guess, to believe them. Thompson, 72, now has cancer in his liver, a lung, and a kidney. He pays $2,200 a month for treatment that would be free at a Veterans Affairs hospital if the Air Force recognized him as a victim of radiation. But for 50 years, the Air Force has maintained that there were no harmful radiation effects at the crash site. It says the danger of contamination was minimal, and strict safety measures ensured that all the 1,500 troops who cleaned it up were protected. Phillips notes that, quote, interviews with dozens of men like Mr. Thompson and details from never-before-published declassified documents tell a different story. Radiation near the bombs was so high it sent the military's monitoring equipment off the scales. Troops spent months shoveling toxic dust. And when tests taken during the cleanup suggested men had alarmingly high plutonium contamination, the Air Force threw out the results, calling them clearly unrealistic. In the decades since, writes Phillips, the Air Force has purposely kept radiation test results out of the men's medical files and resisted calls to retest them, even when the calls came from one of the Air Force's own studies. Many men say they are suffering with crippling effects of plutonium poisoning. Of 40 veterans who helped with the cleanup of the New York Times identified 21 had cancer, 9 had died from it. It's impossible to connect individual cancers to a single exposure to radiation, notes Phillips, and no formal mortality study has ever been done to determine whether there is an elevated incidence of disease. The only evidence the men have to rely on are anecdotes of friends they watch wither away. Quote, John Young, dead of cancer, Dudley Easton, cancer, Vermansky, cancer, and Larry Sloan, said Larry Sloan, 76, in an interview, laboring through tremors caused by a neurological disorder. At the crash site, Sloan, a military police officer at the time, said he was given a plastic bag and told to pick up radioactive fragments into their hand. A couple of times they checked me with a Geiger counter and went clear off the scale, he said. But they never took my name, never followed up with me. Monitoring of the village in Spain has also been haphazard, declassified documents show. The United States, writes David Phillips, promised to pay for a public health program to monitor the long-term effects of radiation there, but for decades provided little funding. Until the 1980s, Spanish scientists often relied on broken and outdated equipment and lacked the resources to follow up on potential ramifications, including leukemia deaths in children. Today, several fenced-off areas are still contaminated, and the long-term health effect on villagers is poorly understood. Many of the Americans who cleaned up after the bombs are trying to get full health care coverage and disability compensation from the Department of Veterans Affairs, notes Phillips. But the department relies on Air Force records, and since the Air Force records say no one was harmed in Palomares, the agency rejects claims again and again. The Air Force also denies any harm was done to 500 other veterans who cleaned up a nearly identical crash in Thule, Greenland in 1968. Those veterans tried to sue the Defense Department in 1995, but the case was dismissed because federal law shields the military from negligence claims by troops. All the named plaintiffs have since died of cancer. In a statement, the Air Force Medical Service said it had recently used modern techniques to reassess the radiation risk to veterans who cleaned up after the Palomar's accident, and, quote, adverse acute health effects were neither expected nor observed, and long-term risk for increased incidence of cancer to the bone, liver, and lungs were low, end quote. The toxic aftermath of war is often vexing to untangle, writes Phillips. Damage is hard to quantify and all but impossible to connect to later problems. Recognizing this, Congress has passed laws in the past to give automatic benefits to veterans of a few specific exposures, Agent Orange in Vietnam, that came late, or the atomic test in Nevada, among others. But no such law exists for the men who cleaned up Palomares. If the men could prove they were harmed by radiation, they would have all cost for their associated medical care covered and would get a modest disability pension. But no proof from a secret mission to clean up an invisible poison decades ago has proved elusive. So each time the men apply, the Air Force says they are not harmed, and the department hands out denials. First, they denied I was even there. Then they denied there was any radiation, said Ronald Howell, 71, who recently had a brain tumor removed. I submit a claim, and they deny. I submit appeal, and they deny. Now I'm all out of appeals, he sighed, then continued, pretty soon we'll all be dead, and they'll have succeeded at covering this whole thing up. That's in Monday's New York Times, it and Tuesday's article by David Phillips, which deals with what happened to the town of Palomares, can be read online. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
تمتطي حوزا قزح طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature excerpts from the Left Forum, which was held in New York City this past May of 2016 at the John Jay College. In particular, we focus on a panel on Israel-Palestine moderated by Paul Jay of the Real News Network out of Baltimore with Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein. Once again, we are unable to cover the complete panel in one broadcast, and so we'll feature the Left Forum panel this week and next on This Week in Palestine. We begin with the introduction of the panel by Paul Jay, who will introduce Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, recently appointed, as I'm sure most people know, Avigdor Lieberman as his defense minister. He seemed very unconcerned how this might affect American public opinion or how it might affect a $10 billion weapons package that's being negotiated. And why should he be concerned? The American media is the one that delivers this news to the American people and continues the narrative that Israel is the victim in all of this, so of course they need $10 billion of weapons. It is highly likely that either Secretary Clinton or Donald Trump is going to be the next president. We know that Secretary Clinton's record has been very close to AIPAC and is very much an ally in terms of their objectives. Donald Trump was recently endorsed by Sheldon Adelson. It's clear he has now shown exactly what type of negotiation he plans around the Middle East because he has to fund his election campaign, and we will expect similar policies from him as regards the Middle East. The point here is that it's an extremely dangerous moment for the Palestinian people. The need for a South African-style broad front solidarity movement against Israeli occupation in support of the Palestinian people is even more urgent. So that's what I hope we end up discussing today, how to develop that broad front so we leave here with something to do about it. But in order to get into that conversation, first some background from our two guests who are eminently qualified to give us such background. First of all, next to me, Norman Finkelstein. He's one of the foremost scholars of Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's written about a dozen books on many topics, including U.S. foreign policy towards Israel, the use and abuse of the history of the Holocaust, and Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence. His controversial legacy as an academic was made into an award-winning documentary film, American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. His latest book is Method and Madness, The Hidden Story of Israel's Assault on Gaza. Tariq Ali, on my right, is a writer and filmmaker. He's written more than two dozen books on world history and politics and several novels, translated into over a dozen languages, as well as scripts for the stage and screen. He's editor of New Left Review and contributes to The Guardian, Counterpunch, the London Review of Books. His latest book is The Extreme Center, A Warning. And thank you and help me welcome them. So my first question is for Tariq, and the format's going to be, I'm going to ask some questions, our guests are going to give long answers, I hope, and then there will be some time at the end for some Q&A from the audience. Tariq, it was a few weeks ago an Israeli general compared the fascistization of Israeli society to 1930s Nazi Germany. Talk about that process.
Well, it's good that it came from the mouth of an Israeli general, because if any of us had said it, we'd have been accused of being anti-Semitic or self-hating Jews or whatever other names they call those who criticize Israel rationally. The fact that it was the general, the deputy commander-in-chief of the Israeli Defense Force, who said it did create a certain propaganda crisis for them. He was denounced by Netanyahu himself, but I think the words got home. People began to think that the situation in Israel is getting worse and worse. And this came after a number of events in Israel. The arrest of a soldier for killing a Palestinian, mass mobilizations in favor of that soldier, support for that soldier from many elements within Likud and the extreme right in Israeli politics, the fact that within Israel itself the Palestinians are no longer regarded by a vast majority, not just by a small extremist minority, but by a large majority of the population as something not worth bothering about. And it's this that is worrying certain people inside the Israeli establishment itself. I don't know how many of you saw a documentary some years ago called The Gatekeepers, which was statements by people out of power, when it's much easier to say these things, about how every single Israeli policy in relation to the Palestinians had been a disaster or had failed, and how they had done bad things. This is a serving general inside the Israeli army who is saying this, and it's already, I think, partially. Netanyahu wanted to punish him by openly speculating that he was going to appoint Lieberman defense minister, i.e. putting this extremely nutty semi-fascist in charge of the Israeli defense force, and the serving defense minister has now resigned, saying that this is unacceptable. These are all people inside Likud or on its fringes. So what this indicates to me is, you know, that it's not just that the occupation of Palestine has been horrific for the Palestinian people, but we now have very clear evidence that the occupation of Palestinian lands by the Israeli establishment and by all political parties in power since 1948 is proving to be extremely bad for a majority of Israelis as well, even though they don't seem to recognize the fact just yet. But some of the more intelligent elements inside the Israeli establishment do recognize it and feel unless some stop is put to this, it's going to end badly.
Norman, is it this volume okay? Avigdor Lieberman is someone who actually proposed ethnic cleansings, cleansing of Palestinians from Israel. He actually redrew the map and was taking Palestinian villages and areas and putting them into occupied territories, taking back land. It was straightforward ethnic cleansing. Why do you think it is that Netanyahu is so confident of his position that the appointment of Lieberman isn't going to affect the arms deal and generally would affect his, you know, the positioning right now in terms of the elections?
I think one has to begin with the fact that coming next year we'll be hitting the 50th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. That means, roughly speaking, two and a half generations of Israelis have lived with, and not just lived with, but been active participations in the occupation. And the bottom line is, Israel is a small place. Its population now, I saw the most recent statistic, is about 8.3 million people, which is roughly the size of New York. And the population under occupation is about 4 million people. In order to occupy such a large number of people, relatively speaking, to your own population, even with the Palestinian Authority, it still requires virtually if not literally, aside from those who are allowed to skip army service for religious reasons, it's virtually every single Israeli at this point has been an active participation in a quite brutal occupation. If you look at the histories now written, even the torture of Palestinians, the use of torture against Palestinian detainees, it begins right after the occupation begins. It then reaches a peak during the First Intifada, when Human Rights Watch estimated that tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees were tortured or suffered ill treatment. And leaving aside the torture, the demolition of homes, which was quite pervasive up until a Supreme Court decision, which to some extent diminished it, the point is that a large part of Israeli society has been and had to be, given the roles they were playing, had to be brutalized and to a large extent, inured to the kinds of brutality they were visiting on the Palestinian population. If you don't understand that and you detach Israeli society from what goes on at the leadership level, then you really don't, I think, understand what's going on. Because it's a whole society with a certain small number of exceptions. And even the exceptions will emphasize that they are exceptions. It's a whole society that's just gone over the cliff. If you want to understand Israeli society, the easiest way to grasp it is to look at the documentaries of our own civil rights movement and look at the folks, the white folks in the American South. It's that kind of brutalization that's occurred across Israeli society. And that's unusual. Now, it's no doubt true the United States as a state, as a government, it engages in mass atrocities and brutalities across the planet. But it's a relatively small number of Americans who are actual participants in those acts. That's not true in Israel. Even if you take a figure who's very popular in the United States, he's a kind of strange version of what we used to call a court Jew, namely Jeffrey Goldberg. He plays this kind of strange court Jew, tough Jew role. He never quite sure knows what role to play in order to get his cachet into the White House. But if you take a person like Jeffrey Goldberg, who's a mainstream American figure, and in the media he's looked upon as some sort of representative of American Jewry at its proudest moment. If you read his memoir, Prisoners, he was a prison guard, and he was part of the conveyor belt of torture. He was freely admitting to it. He would bring prisoners to what was called the refrigerator. It's the size of a refrigerator where they put people in for a couple of days. You can use your imagination. Even people like Jeffrey Goldberg, who was a volunteer from the United States, he himself became part of the conveyor belt. And so it's a whole society, including Jeffrey Goldberg as an example, including American Jews who went over, who brutalized and then became inured to that brutality. And so for Israelis, does it really make much difference what maniac happens to be in power? If you look at all of the Israeli assaults on Gaza during Defensive Shield in 2002 in the West Bank, in Lebanon, if you look at the public opinion polls, in every single case, at least 92%, and sometimes as high as 95% of the Israeli population supported those assaults. Basically, they were just massacres. There was, except for the case of Lebanon, there was no war to speak of. And that enjoyed overwhelming support. Now, if you look in the last couple of days, who are the people in Israeli society who are, quote-unquote, sounding the warning about the potential fascistization of Israeli society? Let's leave aside for a moment the deputy commander, whose background I'm not familiar with. The most prominent person right now is the ex-defense minister, Ya'alon. Now, he quit, he said, because of disturbing tendencies in Israeli society, doesn't want to be part of them. Who was Ya'alon? Ya'alon was the defense minister during Operation Protective Edge. Now, if you read Aluf Ben, who's the senior military correspondent for Haaretz, he says, why was Ya'alon shook up? What shook him up? He said, in 2015, when the Duma family child, the one-year-old, was torched, he was very upset. And then the turning point for him was the killing of the wounded Palestinian by the Israeli soldier. What happened during Protective Edge? 550 children were killed, not one. If you read the descriptions in like the UN report on Gaza, which was a dreadful report, it was presided over by a New York State judge, Mary McGowan Davis. You can fill in the rest, you can figure it out. The kids, their body parts were flung everywhere. Children, they have an arm on one roof, an arm on another roof, torsos which couldn't be identified. 19,000 homes were destroyed. But let's be clear, it wasn't destruction as in quote-unquote collateral damage. If you read the Breaking the Silence testimonies, they talk about they went into areas, marked off the areas, systematically laid waste, razed the homes. Now, you know here, like myself, if your computer overloads, or even in my case last night, my keyboard wasn't working, I enter into a panic. I call up everyone I know in the earliest hours of the morning. We have a crisis. There's a crisis. My keyboard doesn't work. But then, Gaza consists 80% of refugees and children and descendants of refugees. Over 50% are children. And now you have this army of Israeli citizens. It's like everyone in this room at a slightly younger age. Everyone in this room, these are ordinary people. Do you know what it means to destroy someone's home? You go into the bedroom, you see the kids' playthings, you go into the closets, the drawers. You know what it takes, the kind of mentality it requires to do that? And that explains why Israel has, in my opinion, has gone over the cliff. The idea that Yah alone would be traumatized by the killing of one kid, or even take the next one who's traumatized. We read today, Ehud Barak is traumatized. He thinks there are ugly tendencies at play. Ehud Barak, it's already forgotten. This whole cycle, the whole cycle of the last 16 years, it began with him, with the fake claim that he made a big offer at Camp David, which was then endorsed by that monster who happens to be married to the other monster. And actually, it convinced a lot of Israelis. I know many Israelis who were completely convinced that a great offer was given them, the Palestinians. They turned it down. There's no one to negotiate with. What was the next thing Ehud Barak did? On September 29th, 2000, the Second Intifada began. He was the one that gave the order, it has to be mercilessly crushed immediately. For those whose memories go back, before the suicide bombers, the suicide bombing didn't begin until March 2nd, 2001. The actual First Intifada, it began on September 29th, 2000. 5 months elapsed before that first suicide bombing. Who created that situation? It was Barak. Within 3 to 4 days, 3 to 4 days, 1 million, 1 million rounds of ammunition were fired at the Palestinians. As one Israeli put it, one for every Palestinian child. That was Barak. And it was because of him, the Second Intifada, for those who remember before the suicide bombings, because that's all we're told about. The Second Intifada started out nonviolently. It was the same mass demonstrations as in the First Intifada. But then with the brutality, the ratio was 20 Palestinians killed for each Israeli killed in the first 3 weeks. It was just a bloodletting. So when I hear Barak and Yah alone are worried by this sudden appearance in Israeli society of fascism, you have to take it with a big boulder of salt. On the other hand, but I'm going to stop here because Paul said you can answer at length. I was once told when I was debating in Canada, they said the wrong thing to a Brooklyn Jew. They said, be aggressive. I don't want to tell you what happened.
Okay, I was in Beirut in 2012, and I interviewed a young girl. She was about 14, 15 years old, in a Palestinian refugee camp. And I asked her, what would you say to Israeli kids your own age? She said, I'd like to strangle them with my bare hands around their neck. And I said, why? And she said, because I saw on Israeli television when they were bombing Gaza, kids were writing their names on the bombs about to be dropped.
Whoa.
And that mainstream Israeli TV showing this. So this hatred, the anger in these kids for what they've experienced, lived, and witnessed, and seen, does not seem right now to have a way to express itself in a way that's going to be liberating for the Palestinian people. So where are we at in terms of the response of Palestinians now?
Well, I think if we are brutally honest, we have to say that the Palestinian organizations, especially the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which negotiated the Oslo Accords, has participated and collaborated in the defeat that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people.
They want you to hold the mic a little higher.
I think this collaboration was absolutely vital for the Israelis in order to do what they are now doing. And I think the debate and discussion that has now opened up, even within the PLO, is an indication that everyone now knows, there's no secret, not that they didn't know it before, that this is the way they were going. And for a long time it was difficult to say it. I mean, I've been saying it for 10, 15 years in different parts of the world, including at conferences organized by Palestinians themselves. And in private, a lot of them would agree, you're right, but we can't say it in public. I said, you have to say it in public. It shouldn't be left to people like me to say it. You have to say it. Because saying it will be helpful and will not allow the people to get too demoralized. If no one opens their mouths from within the leadership or lower echelons or lower ranking cadres of that organization, we're sunk. And in fact, as we know, the scale of the collaboration was huge. Of the money given to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian Authority, which was Palestinian but which had no authority at all, because never was there a Palestinian Authority. From the beginning, the real authority was the IDF, and behind it the Israeli government, and behind it the White House and the State Department, i.e. the United States of America. So there was never any Palestinian authority. What they had was a budget. Billions came in. A majority segment of this budget was spent on what? Security. Security, let's see what is meant by security. Defending the Palestinian people against the onslaughts of the IDF? No, perish the thought. The security they talked about was to keep their own people under control and to deal with rival factions of Palestinians in Gaza, etc. That's what the bulk of the money was spent on. Where did some of the rest of the money go? It went in enriching those who were organizing this so-called Palestinian Authority. Political leaders, including right at the very top, low-level cadres, they were bought off and told, we've struggled enough, let's enjoy life for a bit. But you know, we're all in favor of enjoying life for a bit if your own people aren't living in such dire and desperate conditions. And this is what was completely ignored. And, you know, I have a very dear friend, a Palestinian poet who lives in Cairo, who told me when I went to Ramallah, a close friend of mine, we had fought together in the old days, took me up the mountain and showed me his brand new villa, which must have cost, God knows, you know, $500,000 or the equivalent thereof. And he said, look, this is how I live now, and I'm happy. And he said, I felt like slapping his face. Because not so far away were people who were living in really appalling conditions. And this money, which could have been used to aid every Palestinian family, to build schools, to build small clinics, etc., etc., was frittered away. And the Israelis knew what they were doing. They were buying off the top layers of Palestinian society within the PLO, and we have now reached a situation where I was at a conference in Spain, in Cordoba, a few weeks ago, sharing a platform with the Palestinian Minister for Finance and Economics. And everything I've said to you, I said to his face. And he admitted, he said, yeah, perhaps we spent too much on security. And I said, what about the $2 billion bribe scandal? And he said, that's exaggerated. No open denial. It's a huge tragedy that the leaders of a movement could be bought off and bought off so easily. So he then turned to me and said, well, what would you do? I said, for one thing, what I would do now really, because enough is enough, is say to the world at large, there is no authority, there is no Palestinian authority. We are going to dump it. It doesn't exist. We are just Palestinians in this region which is occupied by Israel, and dear world and dear people in the world, that's what we are. Are you going to help us? Please do. If not, we'll struggle on and live together and share each other's goods and money as long as we can, because that is what is needed. And he said, well, there's a logic in what you say, but I said the logic, if it exists for you, has come too bloody late for the Palestinian people. They know what you've done. The Israelis do horrific things, as Norman has eloquently described and has been describing for years. But I said being defeated by your own leadership is psychologically and politically very damning. That is much more difficult to get over, because you then say, what alternative do we have? Where are we going? So I say that as long as this is recognized, and they are beginning to recognize it, it's difficult not to, that they have lost the battle for a Palestinian state. That Palestinian state which they dreamed of, even on the 67 frontiers, is not going to happen, because the occupation settlements have just encroached too far into Palestinian territory. There is no Israeli government which is going to remove them, because it won't have the support of its own population to do so. The United States is indifferent, always has been indifferent to the fate of the Palestinians, and more so after the 67 war. So there's going to be no help from the so-called international community, by which is just a code word for referring to the United States. There's no such thing as an international community. So in this situation, far better that the Palestinians acknowledge their situation and then see how to proceed forward. The situation is grim. It's pointless prettifying it or finding hope in tiny things. Not that these tiny things are not important. The BDS campaign is important. It's important not because it'll bring down the Israeli government. That is an illusion, that it will bring down the Israeli government. The South African government was not brought down by sanctions. It was brought down by the defeat inflicted by the Cuban army on South Africa. But sanctions on their own are never decisive. I nonetheless support them. Why? Because it is an important way to project what is going on in the Israel-Palestine, the world of Israel and Palestine, and in the world at large, and on that front it's been effective. The reason the Israeli government is so hostile to it is not that they feel threatened by the sanctions, but because it disgraces them. It shames them. They have to answer questions about it. When campuses in the United States or parts of Europe stand up and say, we demand a boycott of Israel, it shames even the American government, which finds this horrifying, and European governments, which have done absolutely nothing to aid the Palestinians. So these movements, societal movements from below, are extremely important from that particular vantage point, and that's why I was a signatory to them, to it from the beginning, without any illusions, but understanding its importance. And this is why now there's a huge campaign. They've outlawed BDS in France, which, by the way, is the most pro-Israeli country in Europe today. And the appointment of Mark Negev, a friend of Netanyahu's and formerly Netanyahu's press officer, who you probably saw complacent and unctuous on television screens defending the indefensible, is now the ambassador in London to see if he can persuade the Conservative government to do what the French have done and make BDS activities illegal. And allied to this comes a new campaign, which is not new, of course, in the United States, but is new in large parts of Europe, whereby the chief rabbi in Britain said there is no such thing as anti-Zionism that is not also anti-Semitism. Actually said this, and said that anti-Zionism, people who talk about anti-Zionism, are anti-Semitic. Of course, liberal Jews and the Jewish Voices for Peace, thankfully there are many more of these still in British society than the other, came out very strongly denouncing this. So there is a debate going on, and you ask yourself, why is it that suddenly this campaign of anti-Semitism got sparked off in Britain? That's because the Labour Party, to its own horror and shock, the membership has elected a leader who is very well known for being a defender of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian movement. And it is this that has panicked them. So they are denouncing people in his circles, etc. Sometimes Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, says something which is three quarters accurate but not 100%, and says it in a temper without rationally arguing it, so they pounce on him. Or another member of parliament who 2 years ago forwarded one of Norm's texts and satirical blogs — satire is fatal these days — satirical blogs saying that all the Israeli Jews could, of course, come back and live in the United States if they want to, since many of them went from Brooklyn and so whatever. So this is so obviously a satirical blog, and she found it amusing and forwarded it. She's been accused of anti-Semitism, because she was foolish. Instead of saying this is a blog by Norman Finkelstein, I forwarded, then they could deal with Norman directly. But instead, she panicked and apologized and went on her knees. They've still suspended her from the Labour Party, because the worst thing to do in these situations is not to fight back. If you don't fight back, they carry on and on and on. So this is what's going on. And you know, the irony of the situation is that if you want to know the community in Europe which is really suffering, it is the Muslim community. Yeah. There is a huge wave of Islamophobia in many parts of Europe, I would say virtually all of Europe, which in its manifestations is not that different from the attacks that were made on Jewish people in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s and even in the 50s after the Second World War. A lot of the arguments being used against Muslims are very similar. Someone has actually done an analysis of what was written about the Jews and what is being written about the Muslims. Almost exactly the same. And yet, does anyone care? No, well, we do. But by and large, this is completely ignored, because the media is a part of it. So that is the situation that we confront, and of course, you know, we fight it back. But the Palestinians have to understand, and I think increasingly they do, that the state they visualized is impossible. So the only hope, I can't see any other way out, is a solution which many staunch Israeli anti-Zionists from the Matzpen group and others have defended for a long time. And many of them educated me in this whole idea about 40 years ago, that the only viable long-term solution is a single Israeli-Palestinian state with equal rights for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Palestinians, Druids, whatever.
You are listening to a recording of a panel on Palestine, Israel, at the Left Forum held in New York City in May of 2016. We continue with a follow-up question answered by Norman Finkelstein, dealing with the settlements and BDS.
The question was, why not, instead of the blockade, focus on the settlements? The answer is a little bit complicated. Not complicated, but you have to think it through. The blockade, the settlements, there is a strong argument. They are illegal under international law. That's the opinion of the International Court of Justice, all the major human rights organizations, and so forth. So there's a solid phalanx of mainstream public opinion, including, I should also add, the UN Security Council, which has declared the settlements illegal. The main manifestation of the settlements right now, the main manifestation is the wall that Israel has been building in the occupied West Bank. It consumes about 10% of the West Bank, including the critical water resources and some of the best land in the West Bank. The International Court of Justice ruled in July 2004. It said, number one, the wall is illegal. Number two, the wall has to be dismantled. Israel has to dismantle the wall. And number three, if Israel doesn't dismantle the wall, then there's an obligation on the part of the international community to see that the wall is dismantled. That makes it a very tempting target, the wall. The problem is, in the case of the West Bank, between Israel and the Palestinians, there's both the wall and the Palestinian Authority. There is a political wall and there's a physical wall. At this point, I see no evidence in the occupied West Bank of any kind of movement that would have sufficient potential and power to break through both the political wall of the Palestinian Authority and the physical wall that has been created. Though, again, objectively, there's a real possibility there. Because when you evaluate these things, when you try to assess what's possible and what's not possible, in my opinion, the most important thing to look at is, where is public opinion? Where is progressive public opinion? Sometimes I use the expression, what is the political horizon of progressive public opinion? If you want to know the political horizon of progressive public opinion, you look at the mainstream human rights organizations. What have they said? You look at the International Court of Justice. What has it said? You look at the UN General Assembly. What has it said? Those are fairly decent indicators of where the political horizon of public opinion is. And there you have a good case for targeting the wall, but you also have a good case for targeting the blockade, because all the mainstream human rights organizations have declared that the blockade is illegal because it's a form of collective punishment. The whole of, as I said, now reaches even to Bernie Sanders, who says the blockade has to be lifted. The difference is, Hamas itself wants to lift the blockade. They're not doing much about it, and I think their strategy is wrong-headed, but at least the political leadership is committed to it. the West Bank, there's no political leadership that's even formally committed to bringing down the wall. Now, having said that, and trying to fully answer your question, there's a kind of paradox in the BDS movement between what they actually do and what their platform says. There's a chasm. A chasm may be a strong word. Let's just call it a distance that separates the two. If you look at the actual BDS resolutions, say on college campuses, I like to do homework even when Paul told me I don't have to prepare for this. I still have this need to prepare. It goes back to when I was in grade school. I was a nerd. Always had to prepare. And last night, I did take the trouble to go through all the BDS victories for the year 2015, which are listed on their website. And then I proceeded to go to each school which passed a resolution, and the resolution calling for divestment. In virtually every single case for the year 2015, there were 8 victories, I think. In every single case, it targeted the settlements. In fact, in a couple of cases, it explicitly said in the resolution that was passed, we are not BDS. We have nothing to do with BDS. Because they recognize the platform itself, it may be, and in my opinion, it is legally correct. Implementation of the right of return of the Palestinian refugees, full citizenship rights for Palestinians living in Israel, and ending the occupation. That is legally correct. But I said earlier, politics is not just about what's legally right. You have to look at where public opinion is. And BDS activists who are committed, conscientious, give it their all, and are really impressive. The victories have been impressive. But they recognize the limits of public opinion. You can't get a resolution passed if you start calling for full implementation of the right of return. They focus on the settlements. We mentioned earlier, and I'm glad to hear, that Tariq and I agree on the spectacular achievement of the Bernie Sanders campaign. It had to be spectacular. Because last night I gave my 4th contribution. Now, anyone who knows me, that's more than pulling teeth. The moment I read Bernie's campaign, it's down to $5.8 million. He needs money. I want him to win California. I'd also like to see Paul Krugman drop dead. But when he gets up, that's unrelated. But if somebody will if somebody puts something on the website to contribute to, I'll give to that too. That will be my 5th contribution. Bernie Sanders, he's been terrific, a real inspiration. But I'll say 2 things: one about him, and one about us. One of the reasons he's able to do what he's done, it's because for 40 years, he tried to stake out a place in the mainstream spectrum. He didn't go over the top or over the cliff. And so he staked out that place, He always watched which ways the winds were blowing, which you have to do in politics. He waited, he prepared 40 years for this moment. No, he did. I mean, it's no joke. If you listen to, like, the former governor of Vermont, Cunin, I can't remember, Madeline Cunin? She says, oh, yeah, Bernie. He's been saying the same thing since the 70s. He says it again and again. Yes, he did say the same thing. But he never went over. He never went over. And now it's the same message to us. If you listen to what he says, Bernie, he always starts out. I've read every one of his statements. Not that there are that many, but I've read them. No, they're not actually all the same, but they're pretty close. They're pretty close, I'll agree. He always starts out by saying, you have to recognize Israel. You have to recognize Israel. Once you recognize Israel, we can talk. But if you don't recognize Israel, conversation over. Now, do you want to win over Bernie and his followers? Do you want to have a conversation with them? That's a step. Does the BDS platform do that? No, it explicitly doesn't. Explicitly does not do that. And then you have a question. Now, what do you want to do? You want to hug your principles, or you want to play this game they call it constructive ambiguity. I've never understood the meaning of that expression, but okay. Or are you going to do what international law requires of you to do? Because Israel is a state under the state system, is a legitimate state. That's the law. If you want to appeal to the law and say the blockade is illegal under international law because it's collective punishment, if you want to appeal to the law and say the settlements are illegal because under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, an occupying power can transfer its population to occupied land, if you want to appeal to the law and appeal to the law, then the law is Israel's state. So as a matter of not just consistency, though I do believe in politics, consistency has its place, which is another reason why Bernie has such a following. He's not a two-faced hypocrite. He's not duplicitous. But even as a political matter, you can't talk to Bernie unless you recognize Israel. That's just a prerequisite for having a conversation. Now, I was kind of surprised. I don't believe it, actually.
We're close to time.
Yeah, okay. I'm just going to say quickly, I read yesterday that it seems a rumor is now spreading that Bernie's going to make the Israel issue one of the issues he's going to fight for at the Democratic National Convention, that you're going to have to take a more even-handed stance. It's a great opportunity for him.
You have been listening to a recording of the panel discussion on Israel-Palestine taken at the Left Forum held at the John Jay College in May of 2016, featuring Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein.
طفلة تنتطي قوس قزح.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I caught you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. We go riding in the damp, foggy midnight. You snort my good pony.
You're listening to episode 742 of Unwelcome Guests, Solving 9/11, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton,
And, as the title would suggest, we're continuing from where we left off last week. This is Christopher Berlin reading his book, Solving 9/11. We continue with the second part of Chapter 3.
In June 1967, the Israeli Air Force and Navy deliberately strafed, bombed, napalmed, and torpedoed an unarmed U.S. vessel, the USS Liberty, and tried to kill all of its nearly 300 crew members simply to achieve a strategic goal. Recently released documents from the National Security Agency confirm that the United States government at the time had evidence that the Israelis had deliberately attacked the USS Liberty, knowing it was a U.S. vessel. Oliver Kirby, the NSA's deputy director for operations at the time of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, confirmed the existence of the transcripts to John Crudston of the Chicago Tribune in 2007, saying he had personally read them. Quote, asked whether he had personally read such transcripts, Kirby replied, "I sure did. I certainly did." They said, "We've got him in the zero," Kirby recalled, whatever that meant, I guess the sights or something. And then one of them said, "Can you see the flag?" They said, "Yes, it's U.S., it's U.S." They said it several times, so there wasn't any doubt in anybody's mind that they knew it. Kirby, now 86 years old and retired in Texas, said the transcripts were something that's bothered me all my life. I'm willing to swear on a stack of Bibles that we knew they knew. Close quote. The planes involved in the attack reported directly to the commander of the Israeli Air Force, Major General Mordechai Hood. Hood, also known as Mordechai Fine, was from Kibbutz Degania, like Moshe Dayan, the defense minister he served under. Hood left the military in 1975 and created CAL, an Israeli air cargo company. After only 2 years, he left the company and became chief executive of El Al Airlines from 1977 to 1979. In 1985, he founded an unnamed security company, according to his June 2003 obituary in The Guardian. From 1987 until retirement in 1993, he was the chairman of Israel Aircraft Industries. ICTS, the Israeli Airport Security Company, was a key defendant in the 9/11 tort litigation. The ICTS website says this about the company, quote, ICTS International NV was founded in 1982 by a select group of security experts, former military commanding officers, and veterans of government intelligence and security agencies. Close quote. An employee of ICTS told me in 2001 that Huntley USA, their wholly owned airport security subsidiary, had handled passenger screening at Boston and Newark airports on 9/11. As a matter of fact, the Mossad-linked company probably had people at every one of the airports involved in the attacks of 9/11. The ICTS company website says, quote, in 1998, ICTS International NV made a strategic decision to focus on the U.S. market. The following year, it acquired Huntley USA Corporation, which provides airline passenger screening services at 47 U.S. airports, including all the international aviation gateways in the United States of America. The ICTS company developed out of El Al. El Al is the state airline of Israel, their security. The Israeli airline security firm went through a number of name changes as it began providing security to European and American airports. Cover-up. The U.S. government, military, and media all went along with the cover-up of the deliberate attack on the USS Liberty to avoid blaming Israel for the murder of 34 American servicemen, 26 of whom died from a torpedo blast, and the wounding of some 173 others. Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, certainly knows who made the decision to attack the U.S. vessel in 1967. Moshe Dayan, defense minister during the Six-Day War, was a close associate and political ally of Shimon Peres. In 1965, former Prime Minister Ben-Gurion and his closest advisors, including Shimon Peres and Moshe Dayan, broke away from the ruling Labor Party, Mapai, and formed a separate minority faction, the Rafi, or Workers' List. The Crudson article reveals that the Israelis knew very well that the USS Liberty was an American vessel in international waters before they fired the torpedo that killed 26 U.S. servicemen. Quote, 20 minutes later, after the Liberty had been hit repeatedly by machine guns, 30-millimeter cannon, and napalm from the Israelis' French-built Mirage and Mystere fighter bombers, the controller directing the attack asked his chief in Tel Aviv to which country the target vessel belonged. Apparently American, the chief controller replied. 14 minutes later, the Liberty was struck amidships by a torpedo from an Israeli boat, killing 26 of the 100 or so NSA technicians and specialists in Russian and Arabic who were working in restricted compartments below the ship's waterline. Close quote. Sink the target. No survivors. Lieutenant James M. Ennis, Jr., an officer on the bridge of the USS Liberty, wrote his first-hand account of the Israeli attack in a 1979 book entitled Assault on the Liberty. Lieutenant Ennis' book provides evidence that the Israeli attack was deliberate and not an accident of war. Ennis describes how Israeli torpedo boats repeatedly machine-gunned Liberty sailors fighting the napalm fires on deck and shot her life rafts in the water while an oversized U.S. flag flew from its mast. The shooting of the life rafts indicates that the Israelis did not want anyone to survive the assault and intended sinking of the U.S. vessel. Steve Forslund, an intelligence analyst for the 544 Air Reconnaissance Technical Wing in 1967, saw the transcripts from the Israeli pilots and their ground control as they came off the teletype machine at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha. Quote, the ground control station stated that the target was American and for the aircraft to confirm it, Forslund recalled. The aircraft did confirm the identity of the target as American by the American flag. The ground control station ordered the aircraft to attack and sink the target and ensure they left no survivors. Forslund said he clearly recalled the obvious frustration of the controller over the inability of the pilots to sink the target quickly and completely. He kept insisting the mission had to sink the target and was frustrated with the pilots' responses that it didn't sink, he said. Chief Petty Officer Stanley White, president of the Liberty Veterans Association, said, the Israeli planes and gunboats spent more than 1 hour hitting us with rockets, napalm bombs, torpedoes, cannon, and machine gun fire. They machine gunned our firefighters on deck, and they shot our life rafts out of the water. I don't know of a single member of our association who believes the attack was an accident. There are three reasons that have been given as to why the Israelis wanted to sink the U.S. electronic reconnaissance vessel. One, to prevent the U.S. from knowing that Israel was planning to seize the Golan Heights from Syria. Two, to prevent the U.S. from obtaining evidence that Israeli troops were slaughtering some 1,000 Egyptian prisoners of war near Gaza. Three, to destroy the U.S. vessel that was capable of discerning that Israel was sending false communications to Jordan and Egypt to prolong the war until the Israeli military achieved its territorial goals. The U.S. intelligence documents indicate the Israelis attacked the Liberty deliberately. They feared she would monitor their plans to attack the Golan Heights in Syria, a move the United States opposed for fear of provoking Soviet military intervention, Ennis wrote. Wilbur Crane Eveland, an author formerly with the CIA in the Middle East, wrote that the Liberty had intercepted messages that made it clear that Israel had never intended to limit its attack to Egypt. Israeli massacre. The Tribune article of October 2, 2007 about the new revelations concerning the attack on the Liberty reported that the NSA's deputy director at the time, Louis Tordella, speculated in a recently declassified memo that the attack, quote, might have been ordered by some senior commander on the Sinai Peninsula who wrongly suspected that the Liberty was monitoring his activities. The activities that needed to be hidden included the slaughter of some 1,000 Egyptian prisoners of war. Arya Yitzhaki of Bar-Ilan University, who worked in the Israeli Defense Forces History Department, said in an August 1995 interview with Israel Radio that a reconnaissance unit known as Shahed, or Almond, headed by Binyamin Ben Eliezer, had killed hundreds of Egyptians who had abandoned their weapons and fled into the desert during the 1967 war. Yitzhaki said he had investigated six or seven separate incidents in which approximately 1,000 unarmed Egyptian prisoners of war had been killed by Israeli forces. The U.S. Marine Barracks, Beirut, 1983. 16 years later, 241 U.S. Marines died when a Mercedes truck packed with explosives demolished their barracks at Beirut International Airport on October 23, 1983. A similar explosion occurred nearly simultaneously at the French military barracks a few kilometers away, killing 56 French troops. In the wake of the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, President Ronald Reagan sent 1,800 Marines to Beirut to act as peacekeepers. Ariel Sharon and the Israeli leadership, however, resented the interference and used the U.S. presence to commit a false flag operation that killed 241 Marines, according to Victor Ostrovsky in his book on the Mossad, by way of deception. Ostrovsky, a former Mossad officer, reported that Nahum Admoni, the Mossad director at the time, had very specific information about the truck being prepared for the attack on the U.S. Marines, but had intentionally withheld this crucial information from the U.S. military. Quote, "No, we're not there to protect Americans. They're a big country. Send only the regular information," Admoni reportedly said. Admoni, the son of Polish immigrants, was director of the Mossad from 1982 to 1989. In 1947 and 48, Admoni had served in the Shai, the Haganah intelligence branch headed by Yisr Harel, and later in the newly created IDF intelligence agency, Amman. After the 1948 war, Admoni studied at the University of California, Berkeley, until 1954. The purpose of the false flag terror bombings in Lebanon was to create U.S. animosity toward the Arab world and align the United States with Israel, according to Ostrovsky. There had been an earlier car bomb at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut on April 18, 1983, which had killed 17 Marines. The truck bombing compelled the Marines to move offshore, and President Reagan ordered them to be withdrawn from Lebanon on February 7, 1984. Israeli intelligence is suspected of having been involved in the 1983 bombing of the Marine barracks, the deadliest single-day death toll for the U.S. Marine Corps since the Battle of Iwo Jima. War on Terror. The Israeli strategy of using terrorism to instigate U.S. animosity toward the Arab world, which began with the Lavon Affair in 1954, reached its goal of bringing the United States into a fraudulent war on terror with the false flag attacks of 9/11. With its U.S.-led invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, the war on terror was the fulfillment of a key strategic goal for Israeli military planners. To have the armies of the United States and European nations occupying Iraq, the most powerful and advanced Arab nation, has long been the dream of Zionist strategic planners. Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, has explicitly called for a global war on terror since 1980, when his first book, International Terrorism, Challenge and Response, was published by the Yonatan Netanyahu Institute. Netanyahu's appeal for the Western democracies to wage war against Israel's foes was repeated and amplified in his 1986 book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win. Although it is never mentioned as such in the controlled press, it needs to be understood that the pre-planned invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq are, in fact, wars of aggression. To prepare for and carry out a war of aggression is a serious war crime under the Nuremberg Principles of 1950. The United States and its allies convicted and literally strangled to death dozens of senior Nazis at the Nuremberg trials for having committed such war crimes. In the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S. government failed to prove that the terror attacks had been planned, sponsored, or executed by members of the ruling Taliban regime prior to invading Afghanistan. 10 years later, the U.S. government still had not proven a connection between the Taliban regime and 9/11. On June 5, 2006, author Ed Haas contacted the Federal Bureau of Investigation headquarters to ask why, while claiming that bin Laden was wanted in connection with the August 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, the most wanted poster did not indicate that bin Laden was wanted in connection with the events of 9/11. Rex Toombe, chief of investigative publicity for the FBI, responded, "The reason why 9/11 is not mentioned on Osama bin Laden's most wanted page is because the FBI has no hard evidence connecting bin Laden to 9/11. Toombe continued, "Bin Laden has not been formally charged in connection to 9/11. Likewise, there is no evidence of involvement in 9/11 by any member of the regime of the former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Furthermore, allegations that the Iraqi regime had obtained weapons of mass destruction, trumpeted by senior officials of the Bush administration and Judith Miller of the New York Times, turned out to be lies crafted solely for the purpose of deceiving the public and provoking another illegal invasion. The passage of time does not make a war of aggression any less criminal." Decades of planning. The same key people who were involved in the 1954 Israeli terror bombings of the U.S. Information Agency libraries in Alexandria and Cairo were holding high-level positions in the Israeli government in 2001. There are other Israelis with long histories of terrorism and strategic planning who revealed having very specific prior knowledge of 9/11 long before 2001. The highest Israeli intelligence at the time of the Lavon affair, Iser Harel, was evidently aware of the long-term planning of 9/11 more than 20 years before it happened. In 1980, 21 years before the attacks, Iser Harel, the former director of Haganah Intelligence, the Shin Bet, and the Mossad, predicted with uncanny accuracy the events of 9/11 to Michael D. Evans, an American Zionist supporter of the Likud. On September 23, 1980, Evans visited Harel at his home in Israel and had dinner with him and Dr. Reuven Hecht, a senior advisor to Prime Minister Menachem Begin. In an editorial entitled "America the Target," published in the Jerusalem Post of September 30, 2001, Evans related what Harel had told him 21 years earlier in 1980. Quote, "I sat with former Mossad chief Iser Harel for a conversation about Arab terrorism. As he handed me a cup of hot tea and a plate of cookies, I asked him, 'Do you think terrorism will come to America? And if so, where and why?' Harel looked at his American visitor and replied, 'I fear it will come to you in America. America has the power, but not the will to fight terrorism. The terrorists have the will, but not the power to fight America. But all that could change with time. Arab oil money buys more than tents.' As to the where," Harel continued, "New York City is the symbol of freedom and capitalism. It's likely they will strike the Empire State Building, your tallest building," he mistakenly thought, "and a symbol of your power." Close quote. In another article on his Jerusalem Prayer Team website, entitled "Jimmy Carter, Radical Islam's Ally," Evans relates the same story about Harel. Quote, "My last question was, would terrorism ever come to America? 'You have the power to fight it,' he said, 'but not the will. They have the will, but not the power. All of that will change in time. Yes, I fear it will come to New York and your tallest building, which is a symbol of your fertility. Close quote. In 2004, Evans published a book entitled The American Prophecies, Terrorism and Mideast Conflict Reveal a Nation's Destiny. In a subsequent interview, published under the title, Is America in Biblical Prophecy? Evans explained what Harrell meant about fertility symbols. Question. So extrapolating from the scenarios of the Bible, what do you believe is our nation's future based on prophecy? Evans. The story of prophecy that has to do with the Jews goes all the way through to the end of the book of Revelation. Jesus prophesied in Matthew 24. The disciples said, What shall be the signs of the coming of the end of the age? And he said, The first sign would be deception. Now, there's never been greater deception than what happened on September 11th, 2001. Question. Why do you say that America's story is contained within biblical prophecies? Evans. America stepped into the eye of the prophetic storm when it took covenant with both Ishmael and Isaac, the sons of Abraham, the Arab and the Jew. Most of the Bible talks about this battle between these two brothers, and we're right in the middle of it. On September 23, 1979, the founder of Israeli intelligence over dinner told me that America was developing a tolerance for terror. The gentleman's name was Yisr Harel, the founder of Mossad Israeli Intelligence. He ran it from 1947 to 1963. He told me that America had developed an alliance between two countries, Israel and Saudi Arabia, and that the alliance with Saudi Arabia was dangerous and would develop a tolerance for terror among Americans. He said if the tolerance continued, that Islamic fundamentalists would ultimately strike America. I said, where? He said, in Islamic theology, the phallic symbol is very important. Your biggest phallic symbol is New York City, and your tallest building will be the phallic symbol that they will hit. Yisr Harel prophesied that the tallest building in New York would be the first building hit by Islamic fundamentalists 21 years ago. Close quote. The interview with Evans is published online on BeliefNet, a Zionist propaganda network disguised as a religious website. Stephen Waldman is CEO, co-founder, and editor-in-chief of BeliefNet. Previously, Waldman was national editor of U.S. News and World Report, national correspondent for Newsweek, and editor of Washington Monthly. One of BeliefNet's directors is Michael Perlis, the former president of the Playboy Publishing Group. Think about this for a minute. The founder of Israeli intelligence tells an American Zionist in 1980 that Arab terrorism will come to America and that the terrorists will strike the tallest building in New York City. His bizarre prediction, which makes no sense, then comes to pass 13 years later with a fake terror bombing in 1993, evidently set up by the FBI. The FBI-coordinated false flag terror event is then followed 8 years later by a spectacular, well-planned, and extremely lethal attack which kills thousands. So how did Yisr Harel know what Arab terrorists had planned more than two decades before 9/11? Yisr Harel, Mossad's master terrorist. Under David Ben-Gurion, Yisr Harel was the former chief of Haganah Intelligence from 1944, the Shin Bet from 1948, and the Mossad until 1963. Admoni, the Mossad director who refused to warn the U.S. Marines in 1983, had served under Harel. Given his unique position and penchant for terrorism as a means of coercion, the uncanny accuracy of Harel's prediction says more about the years of Israeli planning that went into 9/11 than it does about any criminal plots of alleged Arab origin. After nearly two decades as the head of Israeli intelligence, Ben-Gurion reportedly asked Harel to resign in 1963 because of his use of terror bombings as a means of coercion against the West. Harel, as director of the Mossad, had initiated the Damocles operation of the early 1960s, which was a terror bombing campaign to threaten German scientists and prevent them from helping Egypt develop its defense systems. Two Mossad agents were arrested and jailed in Switzerland for using terror bombs against German scientists. The wife of one scientist was killed in a mysterious explosion. A second scientist disappeared, and the secretary of a third scientist was blinded and mutilated by a mail bomb in Cairo. As Ian Black and Benny Morris, authors of Israel's Secret Wars, A History of Israel's Intelligence Services, wrote, quote, Dr. Heinz Krug, director of a Munich-based Egyptian front company called INTRA, had disappeared mysteriously and was presumed murdered in September 1962. On October 7th, Harel left for Europe to personally supervise authorized operations and the Special Collection Program. In November, Amman, IDF intelligence, sent several letter bombs to the rocket installations in Egypt, and one of them, a large parcel that had been mailed by sea from Hamburg, killed five Egyptians. Someone with a black sense of humor dubbed the campaign post-mortem. Close quote. It is interesting to note that Yosef Goel, a columnist with the Jerusalem Post, published an editorial entitled Yisr Harel and the German Scientists on February 22, 1991, in which Israel's English-language newspaper delivered a thinly veiled threat of Harel-type terrorism to European scientists and companies doing business with Arab nations. Quote, the directors and managers of those firms and the experts who work for them should be reminded that they are playing with their lives and the welfare of their families. It would be well if they went back and studied the episode of Yisr Harel and the German scientists in Nasser's missile program of the 1960s. Close quote. The Levon Affair. The Levon Affair, or the Shameful Affair, as it is known in Hebrew, was an Israeli false flag terror bombing campaign against the United States and Britain that was carried out in Egypt in 1954. Israeli military intelligence had set up a terror cell of sleeper agents in Egypt, which was activated in July 1954 to blow up U.S. and British targets. The Israeli operation was codenamed Susanna. The false flag terrorist bombings were meant to be blamed on Egyptians in order to alienate the United States and Britain from President Gamal Abdel Nasser and prevent Egypt from nationalizing the Suez Canal. The Levon Affair is seldom discussed in the media or in university courses on Middle Eastern history. Strict censorship in the Israeli media even prevented the Israeli public from knowing about the affair for many years. Only in 2005, 51 years after the bombings, did Israel finally admit responsibility for its 1954 false flag terrorist bombing campaign in Egypt. The bombings were carried out between July 2nd and July 27, 1954, by a covert terror cell composed of about one dozen Egyptian Jews under the command of Israeli intelligence agents. The Israeli-run terror cell was discovered and broken up on July 27, 1954, when one of its members was caught in Alexandria after the bomb he was carrying exploded. An Israeli terrorist cell, Unit 131, was reportedly responsible for the bombings. At the time of the incident, Unit 131 is said to have been the subject of a dispute between Amman and Mossad over who controlled it. The Egyptian operatives had been recruited several years earlier when an Israeli intelligence officer named Avram Dar went to Cairo posing as John Darling, a British citizen from Gibraltar. Dar recruited Egyptian Jews who had helped the Mossad with illegal immigration to Israel and trained them for covert operations. The Israeli terror cell went to work in the summer of 1954. On July 2nd, a post office in Alexandria was firebombed. On July 14th, the U.S. Information Agency libraries in Alexandria and Cairo and a British theater were bombed. The bombs contained nitroglycerin and were placed on the shelves of the libraries. After the terrorist cell was discovered, three of the Israeli terrorist commanders succeeded in fleeing Egypt and the fourth committed suicide. After the trial in Cairo, two of the accused Egyptians were condemned to death and executed, and eight were condemned to long terms of imprisonment. Moshe Sheret. The Israeli Prime Minister and Foreign Minister at the time, Moshe Sheret, was evidently unaware of the intrigue, which had been carried out by disciples of David Ben-Gurion, namely Yisra Harel, Moshe Dayan, and Shimon Peres. Sheret, born Shertok in Ukraine, was Israel's first foreign minister from 1948 until 1956, and second prime minister from 53 to 55. Sheret held both positions at the time of the Israeli terror campaign. Sheret, who appears to have known nothing about the terror ring, only became informed of the facts afterwards. In October 1953, shortly before Ben-Gurion took a two-year hiatus in the Negev desert, leaving Sheret in charge, he appointed Pinhas Lavon, a staunch supporter of the retaliation, that is, terrorism policy, as Minister of Defense, and nominated Moshe Dayan as Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces. When Sheret was told of Ben-Gurion's decision to nominate Dayan as Chief of Staff, he penned this note in his diary, quote, "The new Chief of Staff's immense capacity for plotting and intrigue-making will yield many complications," close quote. Lavon, terrorize the West. Pinchas Lavon, Israel's Minister of Defense at the time of the bombings, was part of a group of military leaders who advocated the use of terrorism against the Western nations, particularly Britain and the United States. This group included the Polish-born immigrants David Ben-Gurion and Shimon Peres, otherwise known as Shimon Pershki, and Moshe Dayan, the kibbutz-raised son of Ukrainian immigrants. In January 1955, Sheret wrote about Lavon to Aharon Barkat, Secretary General of the Mapai Party. Quote, "He, Lavon, inspired and cultivated the negative adventuristic trend in the army and preached the doctrine that not the Arab countries, but the Western powers are the enemy, and the only way to deter them from their plots is through direct actions that will terrorize them." Close quote. When the Israeli terrorist plot against Britain and the United States was exposed, Ben-Gurion blamed Lavon, who in turn blamed Colonel Benjamin Givli, another Ben-Gurion protege, and the head of Amman, Israeli military intelligence. Lavon said that Givli had organized the covert operation behind his back. Sheret and Israeli terrorism. Prime Minister Sheret, however, had no doubts about the guilt of the Dayan Peres Givli clique, according to the late Israeli historian Levia Rokach, the daughter of Israel Rokach, the former mayor of Tel Aviv and minister of internal affairs in the Sheret government. Quote, "For him, Sheret, the question of who gave the order was secondary to the necessity of pronouncing a judgment on the ideology and politics of Israel's terrorism. Therefore, while he had no doubts about the guilt of the Dayan Peres Givli clique, to him, Lavon's political responsibility was also inescapable." Close quote. As Sheret wrote about Lavon on January 10, 1955, quote, "People ask me if I am convinced that he gave the order. But let us assume that Givli had acted without instructions. Doesn't the moral responsibility lie all the same on Lavon, who has constantly preached for acts of madness and taught the army leadership the diabolic lesson of how to set the Middle East on fire, how to cause friction, cause bloody confrontations, sabotage targets and property of the powers, and perform acts of despair and suicide?" Close quote. As a moderate Zionist, Sheret believed that Israel's survival would be impossible without the support of the West, Rokach wrote, but that Western morality and interests in the Middle East would not support a Jewish state which, quote, "behaves according to the laws of the jungle and raises terrorism to the level of a sacred principle." Shimon Peres, Frighten the West. In May 1947, Ben-Gurion drafted Shimon Peres into the Haganah High Command, where he was initially put in charge of manpower and later became involved in arms procurement and production. Peres served as chief of the Naval Department in 1948 and was sent to the United States in 1950 on an arms procurement mission. Peres was instrumental in acquiring weapons for the Haganah and establishing the Israeli defense industries, especially the aircraft and avionics industries, according to his biography. He is also known as the godfather of Israel's high-tech defense industries and illegal nuclear arsenal. Peres built an alliance with France that secured a source of arms and was responsible for the program to develop nuclear weapons for Israel, convincing the French to help Israel build a secret nuclear reactor at Dimona in the Negev Desert in 1957. It was Peres who acquired the French Advanced Dassault Mirage III jet fighters that the Israeli Air Force used to attack the USS Liberty in 1967. About Shimon Peres, whom Sherrod considered to be one of the key planners of the terror bombing campaign of U.S. institutions in Egypt, he wrote this note in 1955. Quote, Peres shares the same ideology as Levon. He wants to frighten the West into supporting Israel's aims. Close quote. 2 years later, in 1957, Sherrod wrote even more critically about Peres. Quote, I have stated that I totally and utterly reject Peres and consider his rise to prominence a malignant, immoral disgrace. I will rend my clothes in mourning for the state if I see him become a minister in the Israeli government. Close quote. Sherrod's terrorist adversaries, Ben-Gurion, Dayan, and Peres, however, prevailed and dealt a crushing blow to the very hypothesis of moderate Zionism, Rokach concluded. Quote, in the final analysis, the West, and in particular the United States, let itself be frightened or blackmailed into supporting Israel's megalomaniac ambitions because an objective relationship of complicity already existed, and because once pushed into the open, this complicity proved capable of serving the cause of Western power politics in the region. Close quote. The immense profits that have flowed into the coffers of Western drug and oil cartels as a consequence of the Anglo-American control over the opium production of occupied Afghanistan and the oil of occupied Iraq illustrate Rokach's view that Israeli false flag terror is capable of serving the cause of Western power politics in the region. As Rokach concluded in her study of Sherrod's diary and documents, quote, just as Zionism, based on the depalestinization and the Judaization of Palestine, was intrinsically racist and immoral, thus the West, in reality, had no use for a Jewish state in the Middle East which did not behave according to the laws of the jungle, and whose terrorism could not be relied on as a major instrument for the oppression of the peoples of the region. Close quote. By April 1957, Sherrod realized that the hardline terrorist faction headed by Ben-Gurion and his protégés Dayan and Peres had won, and that he and his vision of moderate Zionism had lost. Quote, I go on repeating to myself nowadays, admit that you are the loser. They showed much more daring and dynamism. They played with fire, and they won. The public, even your own public, does not share your position. On the contrary, the public now turns even against its masters, and its bitterness against the retreat from Sinai and Gaza is developing into a tendency to change the political balance in this country in favor of the former Irgun terrorist leader, Menachem Begin. His, as Sherrod's, defeat in internal Israeli politics reflected the ascendancy of the positions of Ben-Gurion, Dayan, and others, including Peres, who were not reluctant to use force to attain their goals, Noam Chomsky wrote in his foreword to Rokach's book. Quote, his diaries give a very revealing picture of the developing conflict as he perceived it and offer an illuminating insight into the early history of the State of Israel, with ramifications that reach to the present and beyond. Close quote. 9/11 and the War on Terror are clearly two ramifications of the victory of the terrorist Zionists that reach to the present. Had Moshe Sheret, the Israeli Prime Minister, spoken frankly and torn up the mask of secrecy surrounding the Israeli terror bombings, he could have changed the history of the Middle East, as Rokach wrote. Quote, at this point, Sheret could have changed the history of the Middle East had he spoken frankly and directly to public opinion, which was deeply troubled by the events in Egypt, the arrests, the trial, the executions, the contradicting rumors, the climate of intrigue surrounding the affair. By tearing up the mask of secrecy, denouncing those who were responsible, exposing his true convictions in regard to Israel's terroristic ideologies and orientations, and proposing an alternative, he could have created for himself the conditions in which to use the formal powers that he possessed to make a radical house cleaning in the security establishment. The impact of such an act would have probably been considerable, not only in Israel itself, but also in the Arab world, especially in Egypt. The downfall of Levon on one hand, and of the Ben-Gurionist gang headed by Dayan and Peres on the other hand, might have blocked Ben-Gurion's return to power, and in the longer range, the Sinai-Suez War. Events since then would have taken a different course. Close quote. Unfortunately, the Ben-Gurionist gang, headed by Dayan and Peres, came to power. Peres, who had been appointed to high-level positions, was elected to the Knesset in the 1959 elections. Peres, the former Director General of the Ministry of Defense under Moshe Dayan, then became the Deputy Defense Minister, a position he held until 1965, when he was implicated with Dayan in the Levon affair. On June 5, 1967, Israel started the Six-Day War when it launched a preemptive attack against Egypt and its air force. Yitzhak Rabin was chief of staff, and Moshe Dayan was minister of defense during this crucial war that reshaped the Middle East. Ben-Gurion and his gang of Dayan and Peres had formed a new party in 1965, Rafi, partly due to their involvement in the Levon affair. Dayan and Peres had worked closely together since their days in the Haganah. Shimon Peres, Terrorist-in-Chief. Shimon Peres, a most unsuitable recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994, has a long history of terrorism which is not well known in the West. Peres, the octogenarian president of the State of Israel, has a record of involvement in terrorist crimes over a period of more than 5 decades. Peres is a survivor of the struggle among Zionists between the militant hardliners who promoted the use of violence and terrorism and the moderates who opposed terrorism and advocated the use of diplomacy. Shimon Peres is a hardliner. Born Shimon Perski in Poland on August 2, 1923, Peres is the first cousin of Lauren Bacall, the Brooklyn-born Betty Joan Perski. This relationship is a good example of how Zionist Jewish families from the Pale of Settlement often established branches in Israel and the United States in the early 1900s. In 1947, the Polish-born Zionist leader David Ben-Gurion, born David Grun, met Shimon Peres, then age 23, at Haganah headquarters and made him responsible for manpower and arms purchases for the underground Zionist militia Ben-Gurion commanded in Palestine. Peres became a protege of Ben-Gurion. After the bombing of the King David Hotel and other terror killings by the Haganah and other Zionist terror groups, the British withdrew from Palestine. The armed gangs of Zionist immigrants and veterans of the Red Army then turned their skills of terrorism, which some had gained during World War II, against the indigenous population of Palestine. Nearly 400 Palestinian towns and villages were completely obliterated or ethnically cleansed during the 1947-48 Zionist conquest of Palestine. Peres was also the chief of the Israeli Navy, whose main task at the time was the illegal smuggling of men and arms for the Zionist forces in Palestine. Peres assumed the position of director of the Defense Ministry's procurement delegation in the United States after the 1947-48 war, according to his biography. As director of arms procurement in the United States, Peres was responsible for organizing illegal arms smuggling. Transfers of weapons and planes to Zionist forces in Palestine violated the U.S. Neutrality Act. Much of the Haganah arms smuggling activity was run from an office above the syndicate-owned Copacabana Club in New York City, where Peres and Teddy Kollek, the Hungarian-born son of the director of the Rothschild Bank in Vienna, worked closely with the crime syndicate headed by the leading Jewish gangsters of the time. After World War II, Kollek had been sent to New York to serve as the Haganah representative and head of its weapons purchasing team in New York. Also deeply involved in the Zionist arms smuggling were the American Jews Adolf Schwimmer and Hank Greenspun. Greenspun, the Las Vegas-based publicist for mobster Benjamin or Bugsy Siegel, was eventually pardoned for his crimes by President Bill Clinton, a close friend of the Greenspun family. In 1951, at the request of Ben-Gurion, Schwimmer and Peres founded BEDEC, the military's aviation firm that became Israel's largest company, Israel Aircraft Industries. In 1952, the same year Ben-Gurion made Isser Harel the head of the Mossad, he appointed Peres to be Deputy Director General of the Ministry of Defense. The next year, at the age of 29, Peres became the youngest ever Director General of the Defense Ministry, a position he held until 1959. It is interesting to note that Peres never attended university or served in the army, according to the Israeli daily Haaretz of June 14, 2007. As Director General, Peres was a founder of Israel's military and its subsidiary, Israel Aircraft Industries. Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, put Peres in charge of the establishment of Israel's unlawful nuclear program and secret reactor at Dimona in the Negev Desert. Peres has never been popular with Israeli voters. Although he served twice as prime minister, he was never elected to that position. In 2000, he even lost a parliamentary election for the presidency to Moshe Katsav, an Iranian Jewish immigrant. Peres served as Israel's foreign minister under the Likud right-wing Ariel Sharon from early 2001 until November 2002. In July 2007, at nearly 84 years of age, Peres finally won the presidency, but only after Katsav was forced to leave office under a storm of allegations of rape and sexual misconduct. One might wonder why an 84-year-old man would want to be president. Is this an example of the maxim, no rest for the wicked? Is Peres still working because he needs to protect the critical secrets about 9/11 and the war agenda it launched? Oddly, prior to 9/11, Peres, a politician from the left, held the most powerful position of deputy prime minister and foreign minister in a government led by a prime minister from the extreme right, Ariel Sharon. Peres held these positions in the Israeli government from March 3, 2001 until November 2, 2002. Sharon, who reportedly became comatose in January 2006, is a well-known Israeli terrorist and war criminal with a long record of committing atrocities in Palestine and Lebanon. Peres, godfather and chief architect of Israel's high-tech military and unlawful nuclear arsenal, is a person who has always supported the use of terror to coerce the West to support Israel's strategic goals. He has been involved, at the highest level, in numerous covert false flag terrorist operations, such as the Lavon Affair, which was even kept secret from the Israeli Prime Minister at the time. Did Peres use his senior position in a government of like-minded terrorists to launch the false flag terror attacks of 9/11 in order to coerce the United States and the West into the Zionist planned war on terror? Shimon Peres has the credentials of a Zionist arch-terrorist. Furthermore, he has the record, the worldview, and the capability to be an architectural-level planner of 9/11. Is Peres one of the masterminds behind the terrorist crime of the century? Were Isser Harel and Mordechai Hod also involved in the planning of 9/11? To help identify the architectural-level planners behind the false flag terrorism of 9/11, we need a better understanding of how such terrorist attacks can be carried out within the context of anti-terrorist exercises. One military exercise being conducted on 9/11, for example, simulated a passenger plane crashing into a military building near the Pentagon. Was there a connection between the simulated attack and the real one? Chapter 4. The Terror Drills That Became Real. 9/11, the London bombings, and the sinking of Estonia. Quote, "The easiest way to carry out a false flag attack is by setting up a military exercise that simulates the very attack you want to carry out." Captain Eric May, former U.S. Army military intelligence officer. The Terror Drills That Became Real. 9/11, the London bombings, and the sinking of Estonia. The past two decades have been marked by a large number of terror events which remain unsolved to this day. Several of these events involved heinous crimes of mass murder and are similar in a remarkable way. These are the disasters which occurred during security drills or military exercises in which the scenario was incredibly similar, if not identical, to the real-life terror attack. Understanding the nature of the exercises that formed the background and framework for these attacks is essential to understanding how the attacks were carried out. The fact that these real-life terror events occurred within the context of virtually identical exercises has been completely ignored by the media, as if the exercises had never happened. Of the major terror events that occurred during such exercises, we will look at three specific examples: the aerial attacks of 9/11, the bombings of the London Underground and a bus in 2005, and the sinking of the Baltic ferry Estonia in 1994. While there certainly have been other major disasters that occurred within the context of military exercises, such as the sinking of the Russian submarine Kursk in 2000 and the 1988 downing of Iran Air Flight 655 by the USS Vincennes in the Persian Gulf, the three events being discussed here involved attacks on civilian transportation systems far from any war zone. The three disasters were all handled in the same way by their respective governments and media. In each case, before a proper investigation could begin to establish the facts and examine the evidence, a politically acceptable explanation was put forward by government officials and repeated without question by the mass media. Evidence that contradicted the official version of events was confiscated, destroyed, or simply ignored. The extremely hasty and improper destruction of the steel from the World Trade Center, for example, must rank as the most egregious case of destruction of evidence from a crime scene in American history. In late September 2001, officials uncovered a criminal scheme to divert metal to dumps in Long Island and New Jersey. Some 250 tons of scrap metal were found at unofficial dump sites. In November 2001, the trucks carrying steel from the World Trade Center were outfitted with a global positioning system, GPS, device monitored by an Israeli named Yoram Shalmon of Power Lock Technologies of Toronto, a contractor in the cleanup project. Shalmon was then able to track nearly 200 trucks in real time as they carried the crucial steel evidence to the scrapyards that destroyed it using PowerLock's Vehicle Location Device, VLD. Each VLD unit cost about $1,000. We were able to start identifying patterns of behavior. If a driver arrived late, the traffic analyst would look at why. Maybe the driver stopped for lunch, or maybe he ran into traffic, Shalmon told Jacqueline Emmy of SecuritySolutions.com. 99% of the drivers were extremely driven to do their jobs. But there were big concerns because the loads consisted of highly sensitive material. One driver, for example, took an extended lunch break of an hour and a half. There was nothing criminal about that, but he was dismissed. There were also cases where trucks did little detours from their routes, Shalmon said. Likewise, during the official dive for evidence to the wreck of Estonia, on which more than 852 people are known to have died, the crucial locking bolt from the bow visor, which officials say caused the catastrophe, was thrown back into the sea. The bolt had been removed by divers and brought to the surface for investigation, only to be thrown back by Börje Stenström, the Swedish Navy commander, who was the head of the technical group of the International Investigation Commission. According to German investigators, Stenström threw away the bolt, which, according to his own explanation of the sinking, was, quote, one of the most important pieces of evidence, close quote. The first rule in managing a criminal cover-up is to control access to the evidence. The second rule is to destroy any and all evidence that contradicts the official version of events. The fact that these three disasters all occurred during exercises that simulated similar terror scenarios has been ignored by the mass media, which has treated these extremely uncanny coincidences as complete non-issues. Information about the exercises has been kept from the public. The government cover-ups have been facilitated by the compliant mass media, which has consistently ignored the fact that these disasters occurred within the context of strikingly similar terrorism exercises. The terrorist attacks, for example, that struck New York and Washington on 9/11, and the London bombings of July 7, 2005, were the realization, that is, the making real, of computer-based scenarios that were being staged in the same place at the same time. Would a truly free press ignore the fact that these terror atrocities occurred within the context of terror exercises? The easiest way to carry out a false flag attack is by setting up a military exercise that simulates the very attack you want to carry out, Captain Eric H. May, a former military intelligence officer from the U.S. Army, wrote in an article entitled False Flag Prospects 2008, Top Three U.S. Target Cities. This is exactly how government perpetrators in the United States and United Kingdom handled the 9/11 and 7/7 terror attacks, May writes, which were in reality government attacks blamed on terrorists. False flag terror attacks are designed and carried out with the intention of having a targeted foe wrongly blamed in order to manipulate public opinion and foment war. Captain May certainly knows what he is talking about. He is an expert in military exercises involving simulations. May completed advanced courses at the U.S. Army's School for Military Intelligence Officers at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and served 5 years with the U.S. Army's 75th Division as an opposing forces controller, where he ran contrarian scenarios. May's aim, he says, as a former military intelligence officer who spent 5 years conducting war games, is to warn the public that the next 9/11, constantly promised by officials in the media, is likely to be carried out under the guise of future military exercises. If the American people are aware of pending exercises and the danger they represent, May says, then the exercises cannot go live and affect the very terror events they are supposed to be rehearsing against. 9/11 and the July 7, 2005 bombings in London have smoking guns, proving that the mass murderers were not foreign terrorists, but domestic tyrants, May writes. The smoking guns, he says, are the terror exercises that simulated the attacks that actually occurred. While the terrorism drills created the contrarian scenario framework within which the real terror attacks occurred, it does not necessarily follow that the agency running the exercise is the actual terrorist. The true culprit may be a foreign agency who is covertly but intimately aware of the planning of the exercise. By having access to the critical computer networks involved in the exercise, this outside agency has the ability to hijack the drill and make it go live. While the real terrorists could be from any agency that is involved in the drill, they could also be from a foreign intelligence organization that has gained backdoor access to the computer networks on which the exercise is planned and carried out. Israeli military intelligence, for example, which has long been engaged in supplying enterprise software, such as PTEC, and network security personnel and programs to the U.S. government and military, undoubtedly has backdoor access to these sensitive computer networks. As May says, the smoking gun terror drills disprove the official fairy tale that Islamic terrorists are responsible for these false flag terror attacks. The Arabs and Muslims who have been wrongly blamed for 9/11 and the London bombings have simply been framed, like Lee Harvey Oswald, as part of the deception. London, July 7, 2005. At the exact time of the terror bombings of the London Underground and a bus at Tavistock Square, a man named Peter Power and his crisis management team, Visor Consultants Limited, was conducting a terrorism drill for a mysterious unnamed client. The Visor exercise was precisely identical to the bombings that occurred. How likely is such a coincidence? Peter Power had previously worked at Scotland Yard, the anti-terrorist branch, and as a police superintendent in West Dorset, England. In 1993, Power was the subject of a criminal investigation which led to his suspension and retirement from the police in April 1993. Superintendent Power was suspended following an internal police inquiry, which resulted in a file being submitted to the Director of Public Prosecution. Oddly, the details of the Power investigation have been kept classified. After a five-month investigation, Power retired from the police force in September 1993 at the age of 42 on health grounds. This is the real one. Just hours after the London bombings, Power explained the incredible coincidences with the drill his company was conducting in a radio interview with Peter Allen on BBC Five. Quote, Power: At 9:30 this morning, we were actually running an exercise for a company of over 1,000 people in London based on simultaneous bombs going off precisely at the railway stations where it happened this morning. So I still have the hairs on the back of my neck standing up right now. Peter Allen: To get this straight, you were running an exercise to see how you would cope with this, and it happened while you were running the exercise? Power: Precisely. And it was about 9:30 this morning. We planned this for a company, and for obvious reasons, I don't want to reveal their name, but they're listening, and they'll know it. And we had a room full of crisis managers, for the first time they'd met. And so within 5 minutes, we made a pretty rapid decision. This is the real one. And so we went through the correct drills of activating crisis management procedures to jump from slow time to quick time thinking, and so on. We chose a scenario. Peter Power appeared in a television interview on ITV News on the day of the bombings and revealed more details about the terror drill he was involved in. Power: Today we were running an exercise for a company, bearing in mind I'm now in the private sector, and we sat everybody down in the city. 1,000 people involved in the whole organization, but the crisis team. And the most peculiar thing was, we based our scenario on the simultaneous attacks on an underground and mainline station, so we had to suddenly switch an exercise from fictional to real. And one of the first things is, get that bureau number. When you have a list of people missing, tell them. And it took a long time. ITV host: Just to get this right, you were actually working today on an exercise that envisioned virtually this scenario? Power: Almost precisely. I was up to 2 o'clock this morning. Because it's our job, my own company, Visor Consultants. We specialize in helping people to get their crisis management response. How do you jump from slow time thinking to quick time doing? And we chose a scenario, with their assistance, which is based on a terrorist attack because they're very close to property occupied by Jewish businessmen. They're in the city, and there are more American banks in the city than there are in the whole of New York. A logical thing to do. And I've still got the hair... ... One would think that such astounding revelations of a British terrorism expert about how the terror bombings were almost precisely like the exercise he had been conducting for a mysterious company would be of great interest to the media. That has, however, not been the case. There has been virtually no discussion in the mainstream media that the London bombings or other terrorist atrocities and disasters like 9/11 and the sinking of Estonia occurred within the context of security drills that were very similar to what actually happened. Why has this crucial background information been censored? Astonishing first-hand accounts, like Peter Powers, from people engaged in these exercises were reported shortly after the events occurred, yet these important stories were confined to local news outlets and not reported in the major national and international news outlets, in newspapers like the New York Times, for example, whose motto is, "All the news that's fit to print." BBC and the series of explosions at the World Trade Center. Powers' comments about the amazing coincidences with his security drill were censored by the BBC in the same way as the eyewitness report of Stephen Evans, the reporter at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Evans was on the ground floor of the South Tower when planes struck the complex. When he appeared on BBC World Television shortly after the collapse of the Twin Towers, Evans repeatedly described a series of explosions he had witnessed at the base of the tower before it was demolished. From the first minute Evans spoke, however, it was quite obvious that his eyewitness report was being censored by the higher powers at the BBC. When the BBC later revisited the events of 9/11 with Evans, there was absolutely no mention of the series of explosions he had talked about on the morning of the attacks. How can that be? Such blatant and intentional omissions are properly defined as censorship. Evans' astonishing eyewitness account from 9/11 was evidently dropped into the memory hole at the BBC. Peter Powers' revealing comments about the London bombings met the same fate. The BBC has a very peculiar history regarding the events of 9/11. Not only did the British network censor Evans' reports of explosions at the World Trade Center, it also reported that the building known as WTC-7 had collapsed about 30 minutes before the 47-story tower mysteriously fell into its foundation. Jane Stanley, a BBC World Television reporter in New York City on 9/11, reported at about 5:54 p.m., that's 21:54 GMT, that the Solomon Brothers building owned by Larry Silverstein had collapsed. Silverstein's building, however, which he later admitted had been pulled, did not collapse until 5:20 p.m., 22:20 GMT. BBC News editor Richard Porter subsequently wrote on the BBC website in February 2007, "We no longer have the original tapes of our 9/11 coverage for reasons of cock-up, not conspiracy." Close quote. But why would the BBC destroy its original tapes of 9/11? This was the same excuse for destroying evidence given by the corrupt Hoffman Estates Illinois police, who said they had recycled the videotapes they had made of their three-man undercover tactical squad assaulting me at my house in August 2006. For independent journalists to question the controlled media's version of events, from which such significant first-hand accounts have been censored, is to risk being branded a conspiracy theorist. The public is now told that eyewitness reports from people who were actually in the disaster or saw it with their own eyes can no longer be considered reliable testimony. How very odd. Such was the case with the downing of TWA Flight 800 off Long Island, New York, in 1996, when more than 100 eyewitnesses reported seeing what appeared to be a missile streak from the surface of the ocean, strike the aircraft, and cause an explosive fireball. I attended the final presentation of the official TWA 800 report by the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, in 2000, when David Meyer, whose only credential as a panel member was a PhD in applied experimental psychology from Rice University, audaciously dismissed the reports of more than 100 eyewitnesses as the collective hallucinations of intoxicated New Yorkers, based solely on the fact that it was a summer evening. At that point, it was abundantly clear that there was something seriously wrong with the NTSB and their investigation of the downing of TWA 800. The cover-up could not have been more obvious. The plane-into-building drill of 9/11. On 9/11, an agency of the Department of Defense and the CIA was conducting a terror simulation in which an imaginary airplane from Washington's Dulles International Airport were to crash into one of the four towers of the suburban campus of the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO, in Chantilly, Virginia, just a few miles from the Pentagon. The plane that allegedly crashed into the Pentagon, American Airlines Flight 77, departed from the same airport at 8:20 a.m. on 9/11. When the terror scenario became real in New York and at the Pentagon, the NRO exercise was canceled, and nearly all its 3,000 employees, the people who operate the nation's eye in the sky, were sent home. The government said it was a bizarre coincidence that the NRO, a military intelligence agency working under the Department of Defense and the CIA, had planned a simulated exercise with a mock plane-into-building crash on the morning of 9/11. It was just an incredible coincidence that this happened to involve an aircraft crashing into our facility, spokesman Art Haubold told the Associated Press in August 2002. As soon as the real-world events began, we canceled the exercise. As the agency that operates the nation's spy satellites, the NRO personnel come from the military and the CIA. When the attacks occurred, however, most of the 3,000 people who work at the agency were sent home. Why would they do that? The fact that the spy agency had planned such a drill was casually leaked in an announcement for a Homeland Security conference in Chicago in 2002. In a promotion for Speaker John Fulton, a CIA officer assigned as chief of NRO's Strategic Gaming Division, the announcement said, quote, "On the morning of September 11, 2001, Mr. Fulton and his team were running a pre-planned simulation to explore the emergency response issues that would be created if a plane were to strike a building. Little did they know that the scenario would come true in a dramatic way that day." Critical failures. The most pressing questions about why the U.S. military air defense system failed to intercept the four hijacked planes on 9/11 are obviously of crucial importance. Captain May writes that even official apologists call 9/11 the greatest defense failure in American history. How could the most modern and expensive air force in the world fail to intercept four airliners, three of which roamed wild for hundreds of miles before striking landmark buildings in New York and Washington? Why was the U.S. air defense system unable to intercept several large, slow-moving planes as they struck the nation's largest city and its capital? These crucial questions have never been raised by the government-appointed commissions or the media, which have all avoided discussing the military exercises of 9/11. It's not that these drills were not reported, but rather that their connection to the disasters has not been openly discussed and investigated. 4 months after 9/11, the Post-Standard of Syracuse, New York, published an article by Hart Seeley that featured firsthand accounts of the military radar operators of the Northeast Air Defense Sector, NEADS, at the former Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York. These radar operators were the eyes of the U.S. air defense system for the eastern part of the nation on 9/11. In Seeley's article, the NEADS personnel explained how a North American Aerospace Defense, that's NORAD, exercise called Vigilant Guardian, which they were participating in, had caused systemic confusion, which prevented an effective military response to the real emergency. The confusion at NEADS was evident from the moment Boston Flight Control informed them that a plane had been hijacked. At 8:38 a.m., an air traffic controller telephoned Sergeant Jeremy Powell at NEADS to inform him that one of their planes had been hijacked and was headed to New York. Quote, "Is this real world or exercise?" Powell asked. "No, this is not an exercise, not a test," Powell was told, according to the transcripts of the 9/11 Commission report. Seeley's article described the context and the confusion at NEADS. Quote, 6 a.m., War games. Lieutenant Colonel Don Deskins figured it would be a long day. September 11 was day two of Vigilant Guardian, an exercise that would pose an imaginary crisis to North American air defense outposts nationwide. The simulation would run all week and Deskins starting her 12-hour shift in the operations center as the NORAD unit's airborne control and warning officer might find herself on the spot. Day one of the simulation had moved slowly. She hoped the exercise gathered steam. It made a long day go faster. 8:40 a.m., real world. In the ops center, three rows of radar scopes face a high wall of widescreen monitors. Supervisors pace behind technicians who peer at the instruments. Here it is always quiet, always dark, except for the green radar glow. At 8:40, Deskins noticed senior technician Jeremy Powell waving his hand. Boston Center was on the line, he said. It had a hijacked airplane. It must be part of the exercise, Deskins thought. At first, everybody did. Then Deskins saw the glowing direct phone line to the Federal Aviation Administration. On the phone, she heard the voice of a military liaison for the FAA's Boston Center. I have a hijacked aircraft, he told her. American Airlines Flight 11, headed to Los Angeles, had veered off course, apparently toward New York. The liaison said to get some F-16s or something airborne. 41 minutes earlier, Flight 11 had left Logan Airport with 81 passengers. For the last 27 minutes, it had not responded to ground control. Deskins requested Flight 11's latest position, which an operator put up on the screen. Flight 11 wasn't there. Someone had turned off its transponder, the device that identifies the plane to ground control. Boston Center could still track it on primary radar, but the operators in Rome would be hard-pressed to find it amid the jumble of blips on their screens. We'll direct the intercept, the liaison told Deskins. Just get something up there. Deskins ran up the short flight of stairs to the battle cab and reported the hijacked plane. Real world, not a simulation. Not a simulation. What is most peculiar is that Seeley's informative article about the confusion among the critical military radar operators at NEADS was never published or referenced by any national newspaper in the United States. The New York Times, for example, has never even mentioned Vigilant Guardian, the air defense exercise that contributed to the confusion behind the military's failure to protect New York City on 9/11. Oddly, among the national newspapers and news magazines of the United States, Vigilant Guardian was only mentioned once, very briefly, in a Washington Post book review of the 9/11 Commission's report. The review began, "If the 9/11 report had been written as a novel, nobody would believe it. The story is too far-fetched." The Post mentioned Vigilant Guardian when it quoted a little-noticed footnote from the report. Quote, "When FAA officials realize, late, that planes are being hijacked, they can't monitor them or decide what to do. The vice president thinks he has issued orders to shoot down civilian planes, but the pilots in the air don't get the word. The military's Air Defense Command isn't sure whether it's dealing with an exercise or a real event." Incredibly, according to a little-noticed footnote in the report, on 9/11, NORAD was scheduled to conduct a military exercise, Vigilant Guardian, which postulated a bomber attack from the former Soviet Union. Close quote. Vigilant Guardian obviously confused the military because simulated hijackings and false injects, radar indications of non-existent planes, were reportedly part of the exercise. This is why Deskins and others were initially uncertain whether the reports of hijacked planes were real-world or simulation. First thing that went through my mind was, is this part of the exercise? Air Force Major General Larry Arnold, who was at the command center at the Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida, told ABC News. Is this some kind of screw-up? The military's inability to respond effectively to the rogue aircraft of 9/11 was evidently caused, at least in part, by the NORAD exercise. The fact that a similar exercise involving a plane striking a military facility near the Pentagon was being staged on the morning of 9/11 indicates that the computer-based exercises played key roles in the actual terror attacks that occurred. What role the military exercises played in the 9/11 terror attacks and how they could have been hijacked and by whom are questions that need to be answered and which will be addressed in a later chapter. the Estonia catastrophe. The unexplained sinking of the Baltic ferry Estonia on its way to Stockholm from Tallinn in late September 1994 is the third catastrophe, not chronologically, that occurred within the framework of a military exercise. The day before it sank, Estonia had been the scene of a terrorism exercise in which the simulation was a terror bombing of the ferry. Looking at the NATO military assets that were assembled nearby and the terrorism drill that had just been conducted on the ship, the stage was set and the actors in place for what turned out to be a real disaster. The Estonia catastrophe is Europe's worst maritime disaster since World War II. Tragically, 852 people are known to have died when Estonia sank in the early hours of September 28, 1994. More than 1,000 may have perished if the report is true that some 150 Iraqi Kurds were being smuggled to Sweden in a truck. Scores of people died in the frigid water of the Baltic Sea, waiting for rescue boats and helicopters that came too late. More than 90 lifeless bodies were retrieved from the life rafts. NATO's search and rescue exercise. Although it is seldom mentioned, the Estonia catastrophe occurred on the first day of a 10-day NATO naval exercise called Cooperative Venture 94, in which more than 15 ships and a number of maritime aircraft were prepared to conduct humanitarian and search and rescue operations in nearby waters. The NATO exercise, which involved 10 NATO member states and the Baltic partner nations of Russia, Sweden, Poland, and Lithuania, was to be staged in the Skagerrak between Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, and the Norwegian Sea, according to the NATO press release about the exercise from September 16, 1994. The NATO nations who participated in the exercise were Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Spain, United Kingdom, and the United States. Many other allies and partners sent observers to the exercise, according to the NATO press release. The fact that Estonia sank as the submarines, ships, planes, personnel, and satellites from the navies of 14 nations were preparing to begin their 10-day search and rescue operations exercise off the coast of Sweden raises several obvious questions that deserve to be answered. If NATO had 15 ships and a number of aircraft assembled nearby, prepared to conduct a search and rescue exercise, why did they stay away? The Swedish rescue helicopters were ill-prepared and ill-equipped, which resulted in a fatal delay for those waiting to be rescued. Of the 989 people aboard Estonia, only 137 survived. Were there specially equipped rescue helicopters or other aircraft that could have assisted? Drew Wilson, author of The Hole, a book about the Estonia catastrophe, wrote, "Survivors who didn't die from hypothermia while floating on upturned boats or flotsam in the biting water waited 4 to 6 hours for rescue. NATO search and rescue personnel and equipment could have saved some lives. Flying time was under 1 hour. Why didn't they respond to the distress traffic? What happened? The evidence indicates that the Mayday signals from Estonia had been jammed, as were all radio communications in the area. A series of comprehensive malfunctions in regional communication systems, all at once and all at the exact time the ferry had sunk, suggest involvement by a military or intelligence services," Wilson wrote in The Hole. "Was a distress call intentionally blocked? If so, why?" Communications throughout the northern Baltic Sea were disrupted during the time of the accident. As Wilson documents, VHF Channel 16, the International Mayday Channel, and Channel 2182 were blocked. Signal jamming of all radio communications apparently occurred on the southern coastline of Finland as the accident unfolded. Werner Hummel, the German investigator, said that his group had documentation showing that the regional telephone network servicing the catastrophe site failed just as it was needed most. The malfunction was truly a startling coincidence. The telephone company stated its entire radio communications network, for unknown reasons, had been down from 103 to 1:58 a.m., almost exactly the time the Estonia first encountered trouble, until the time it disappeared from radar. Did the NATO communications units prepared for the search and rescue exercise overhear the distress calls coming from Estonia? NATO, with state-of-the-art satellite and airborne surveillance assets in place over the Baltic Sea, certainly must know who was blocking the SOS calls. Why has this information been kept secret since 1994? Blocking SOS calls and jamming distress signals is a violation of international law. Why has this crime not been investigated? The intentional blocking of the May Day signals from Estonia points to complicity in mass murder. Naval exercises are meant to be as realistic as possible. Olivier Schmidt, director of the Intelligence Files, Today's Secrets, Tomorrow's Scandals, writes. What was the search and rescue scenario of NATO's Cooperative Venture 94 exercise, which was commanded at sea by the Dutch submarine commander Gijsbert Goffert Hooft? I sent a series of questions to Robert Pagel, NATO's press officer for Baltic issues, about NATO's response to the Estonia catastrophe. Quote, did NATO have any naval assets in the Baltic Sea on the night of September 27, 28, 1994? And what actions did NATO take in the immediate aftermath of the Estonia disaster? Did NATO pick up the May Day signals being sent and jammed from Estonia? Why didn't NATO assist, given the urgent need to retrieve hundreds of freezing people from life rafts? What was the scenario of NATO's search and recovery exercise? Close quote. Despite telephone calls and email exchanges with the press office at NATO headquarters, Robert Pagel failed to respond to a single question about NATO's failure to respond to the Estonia catastrophe. Drew Wilson met the same wall of silence at NATO when he asked questions about Estonia for his book, The Hole. NATO had 14 ships, submarines, aircraft, and personnel from the United States, Europe, Sweden, and Russia assembled near the scene of the sinking of Estonia. If NATO has a reasonable explanation for its failure to respond to Europe's worst maritime disaster since World War II, why is it unwilling to provide it? Estonia's bomb drills. The Estonia ferry had been the object of bomb threats and had participated in at least two terror bomb exercises in 1994, one in February and another one just the day before it sank. On February 2, 1994, Estonia was the subject of a major mock bomb exercise conducted with RITS, Sweden's Maritime Fire and Rescue Agency, and the Stockholm Police. The Stockholm Police had requested to take part in the exercise and used bomb-sniffing dogs to find explosives. The terror simulation involved a scenario in which bombs had been placed in the sauna and swimming pool area on the lowest deck, below the waterline in the bow of the ship. A second bomb was placed in the sleeping quarters on the first deck, also below the waterline. In the Estonia terror scenario, the explosives in the sauna were to be found by the dogs, while the second bomb was to explode. The purpose of this terrorism drill was to train with the ship's crew and include shore-based terrorism experts and police with bomb-sniffing dogs brought to the ship by helicopter. In the simulation, the bombs were set to explode about halfway between the Estonian and Swedish coasts, which is where the ship actually sank in September 1994 after a similar mock bomb exercise. When Estonia sank, a bomb drill on the ship had just been concluded. Survivors from the sinking actually reported hearing two huge explosions immediately before the ship listed to starboard. Several crew members testified to having heard the coded fire alarm, Mr. Skylight to number 1 and 2, over the ferry's public address system at about 1:02 a.m., after the vessel had listed severely. This is the message for the crew that was used during the previous bomb drill in February 1994. Mr. Skylight was a signal for the firefighters to go to fire stations 1 and 2 and prepare for damage control. The coded alarm indicates that there was damage caused by a fire or explosion that required immediate attention. The massive ferry, 150 meters in length, sank in less than 30 minutes. The fact that the ship sank extremely quickly and the eyewitness reports from survivors suggest that explosives had torn a large hole in the hull below the waterline, as in the drill. Swedish policemen who had just conducted training involving a mock bomb threat on the ferry were returning home when Estonia sank. Of the 70 policemen, only 7 survived. According to survivors, Estonia sank after 2 explosions rocked the ship in the middle of the night. A drill of a bombing simulation on the ship had just been completed the day before. It is now known that the passenger ferry was being used to transport Soviet military contraband when it sank. The highest officials in Swedish customs, government, and military were aware of the sensitive and illegal shipments that put the ferry and her passengers at risk. Is this why they have been so dedicated to protecting the lies about the sinking? Chapter 5. Why did crucial computer systems fail? Quote, PTEC was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11. Their specific job is to look at interoperability issues the FAA had with NORAD and the Air Force in the case of an emergency. If anyone was in a position to know that the FAA, that there was a window of opportunity or to insert software or to change anything, it would have been PTEC along with MITRE. Close quote. Indira Singh, IT and risk consultant with J.P. Morgan Chase and DARPA, at the 9/11 Citizens Commission hearings, New York City, September 9, 2004. Why did crucial computer systems fail? The dependence of the U.S. government and military on computer systems, which often run software provided by outside vendors, is an Achilles heel of the world's most powerful nation. The failure of crucial computer systems on 9/11 is proof of that fundamental weakness and vulnerability. Apart from being a monstrous crime of mass murder and false flag terrorism, 9/11 was also a sophisticated computer crime, carried out through long-term foreign infiltration of the most sensitive U.S. military and government computer networks. This infiltration gave the perpetrators real-time access to all the data on the computers of the U.S. government and military. On 9/11, this super-user access gave the people behind the terrorist attacks the ability to thwart a military response to the emergency as it developed. PTEC and 9/11. The subject of computer sabotage in relation to the aerial attacks of 9/11 was first raised by Indira Singh, who spoke at some of the early 9/11 conferences. During these 9/11 truth events, Singh talked about a small Massachusetts-based software company called PTEC, which she said was linked to Arab terrorists. PTEC was said to be a startup company from Quincy, Massachusetts, whose software was running on the most sensitive computer systems of the U.S. government, including those of the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, and the U.S. Air Force, two agencies whose computer systems evidently failed on 9/11. Singh, a senior risk and IT consultant with J.P. Morgan Chase in 2001, is described as a whistleblower because of her revelations about PTEC's involvement with the critical computer systems that failed on 9/11. Quote, PTEC was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11, Singh said. Their specific job is to look at interoperability issues the FAA had with NORAD and the Air Force in the case of an emergency. If anyone was in a position to know that the FAA, that there was a window of opportunity or to insert software or to change anything, it would have been PTEC along with MITRE. MITRE Corporation. The MITRE Corporation has provided computer and information technology to the FAA and the U.S. Air Force since the late 1950s. MITRE is a federally funded research and development center, FFRDC, for the Department of Defense, the FAA, and the Internal Revenue Service. MITRE is a major defense contracting organization headed by the former Director of Central Intelligence, Dr. James Rodney Schlesinger. Schlesinger, who was reportedly made DCI at the request of Henry Kissinger in 1973, later served as Secretary of Defense. Schlesinger, a former director of strategic studies at the Rand Corporation, was described in a 1973 biography as a devout Lutheran, although he was born in New York in 1929 to immigrant Jewish parents from Austria and Russia. MITRE's Command, Control, Communications, and Intelligence, FFRDC, for the Department of Defense, was established in 1958. The C3I, Command, Control, Communications, and Intelligence, supports a broad and diverse set of sponsors within the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. These include the military departments, defense and intelligence agencies, the combatant commands, and elements of both the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to MITRE's website. Information systems technology, it says, coupled with domain knowledge, underpin the work of the C3I FFRDC. The U.S. Air Force maintains its Electronic Systems Center at the Hanscom Air Force Base in Bedford, Massachusetts. The ESC manages the development and acquisition of electronic command and control systems used by the Air Force. The ESC is the Air Force's brain for information, command, and control systems, according to Charles Paoni, a civilian employee of the ESC. It is the product center for the Air Force's Airborne Warning and Control System, AWACS, and Joint Surveillance Target Attack Radar System, Paoni said. Asked about MITRE's role at the ESC, Paoni said, MITRE does the front-end engineering. It's basically our in-house engineer. MITRE employees operate the computer systems at Hanscom Air Force Base, Paoni said. MIT's Lincoln Laboratories, the parent of MITRE, is located on Hanscom Air Force Base. A second FFRDC, the Center for Advanced Aviation System Development, provides computer engineering and technology to the FAA. MITRE's support of the FAA began in 1958 when the company was created. The FAA's Airspace Management Handbook of May 2004, for example, was written and published by the MITRE Corporation. Jennifer Shearman, MITRE's Public Relations Manager for Corporate Identity in Bedford, said that MITRE is a trusted mentor for the FAA and is a unique provider of objective and independent information for the U.S. Civil Aviation Authority. MITRE's Bedford headquarters are located near Boston's Logan Airport, where the two planes that struck the World Trade Center supposedly originated. Bedford lies directly under the flight path of westbound flights leaving Logan. MITRE developed the technology to aid controllers in solving problems while keeping aircraft close to their route, altitude, and speed preferences. Sherman was unable to say why the MITRE technology failed on 9/11. PTEC. In her speeches about PTEC, Indira Singh talked about PTEC's alleged connections with Saudi Arabia, but said little about MITRE. Here's an extract from an interview she did with Pacifica Radio in 2005. Quote, "Maybe those organizations don't fully know who their masters are, and PTEC is the one thread, the one golden thread you pull on, and all of this is unraveled because it goes into the corporations, it goes into these government entities, it goes into the terrorism financing entities that none of which have been, by the way, taken to task. There are just so many questions about what does this all mean. And as I investigated further, we found that the origins of PTEC were very interesting. Where did this company come from, obviously, is the first question. And how did they get to be so powerful? Who were the people? Who were the organizations that brought them in? Who knew? Who gave them the power? PTEC software is utilized at the highest levels of almost every government and military and defense organization in this country, Singh said, including the Secret Service, the FBI, the Department of Defense, the House of Representatives, the Treasury Department, the IRS, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, and last but not least, the Federal Aviation Administration. I found it hard to believe that the most sensitive government and military computers would run enterprise software from a Lebanese-owned startup company called PTEC. All the talk about the Saudi financier behind PTEC being linked to Osama bin Laden seemed fishy. It simply did not make sense that the most secure computer systems of the U.S. government would be running software written by a Lebanese Muslim immigrant financed by a Saudi who happened to be on the most wanted list of global terrorists. Osama Ziada, a Lebanese immigrant who came to the United States in 1985, founded PTEC in 1994. After 9/11, PTEC was said to be connected to the Muslim Brotherhood and Arab financiers of terrorism. The firm's suspected links with terrorism resulted in a consensual examination by the FBI in December 2002. The media reports of the FBI raid on PTEC soon led to the demise of the company. When I turned my attention to PTEC in early 2005, I discovered that a key person involved in the development of the company was a Zionist Jewish lawyer named Michael Goff from Worcester, Massachusetts. Here's what Goff Communications' website said in 2005 about his work with PTEC. Michael was marketing manager at PTEC Incorporated, a leading provider of business process modeling, design, and development software. In this capacity, Michael managed various marketing programs and activities, including public relations, direct mail, web development, collateral, trade shows, and seminars. Additionally, Michael also worked closely with PTEC's sales organization to perform competitive analysis as well as manage lead tracking and fulfillment activities. When Michael first joined PTEC, he shared responsibilities between marketing and information systems for the company. As information systems manager, Michael handled design, deployment, and management of its Windows and Macintosh data and voice networks. As part of this effort, Michael developed Lotus Notes-based systems for sales and marketing, lead tracking, and IS service and support requests. Michael also performed employee training and handled all procurement for software, systems, and peripherals. At the time, March 2005, Goff's website said that he was working for an Israeli-run computer security company called Guardium. Goff's relationship with a Mossad-funded database security company raised my suspicion that PTEC was probably an Arab false front that was actually controlled by Israeli intelligence. Goff would have been their primary agent inside the company. Guardium is less than 5 miles from Hanscom Air Force Base, site of MIT's Lincoln Labs, and about the same distance from Boston's Logan Airport. Guardium, a database security firm, was clearly a Mossad-funded operation. This was evident by the three Israeli venture capital firms that financed Guardium: Cedar Fund, Veritas Venture Partners, and Stage One. A closer look at the key personnel of these firms revealed that they were all manned by high-level agents of Israeli military intelligence. Michael Goff has solid Zionist credentials, which explains why Israeli intelligence would use him as a sayan, that is, a helper who is willing to perform a necessary function for the Mossad. Goff's father and grandfather were highest-level Masons in the Worcester Lodge of B'nai B'rith, the secret Masonic organization of Zionist Jews that was established in New York City in 1843. Goff got involved with PTEC in 1994. When I asked him how he wound up working with PTEC, he told me that he had left his law firm and been placed with PTEC through a temporary agency, although he could not name the agency. I found that rather hard to believe. Why would a young American Jewish lawyer working with a good law firm in his hometown suddenly leave the practice to start working with a dodgy startup software company owned by a Lebanese Muslim and financed by a Saudi? Why the abrupt career change? With this discovery, it seemed clear to me that the Israeli hidden hand behind PTEC had been exposed. My revelations about the Zionist connections at PTEC were published in a newspaper based in Washington, D.C. in April 2005. Singh, however, seemed to ignore the evidence of an Israeli connection to PTEC and continued to talk about the company being linked to Saudi sponsors of terror. In any case, Singh and I were asking the same questions. How did PTEC get to be so powerful? Who gave them the power? Who were the people that brought them in? Who knew? After 9/11, the crucial question was, how did PTEC software get onto the critical U.S. government networks, particularly those of the FAA, the U.S. Air Force, and NORAD? who would have allowed PTEC personnel access to the FAA's core air traffic control system computers in Herndon, Virginia? During my research about the military exercises that were ongoing when 9/11 occurred, I read documents about how the FAA and NEAD's computer systems failed. The FAA in particular was extremely slow to contact the military about the rogue aircraft of 9/11. In one case, one of the rogue aircraft had been allowed to fly without communication for nearly 30 minutes before the military was notified. The heart of the matter. The flawed and delayed FAA procedures and communications with the military are the heart of the matter, as 9/11 relative Kristen Breitweiser said. Quote, "You know, it is very upsetting that the 9/11 Commission had to subpoena the Federal Aviation Administration. According to news reports, there are 150,000 documents that were left out of what the FAA sent to the Commission. These documents went toward the timeline of when the FAA notified the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, when the fighter jets were scrambled, and the communications between air traffic control and the pilots. These are threshold issues that go to the heart of the matter. How did the FAA overlook 150,000 documents pertaining to these issues? It is more than mildly upsetting that they would leave out these documents." Close quote. Monty Belger at the FAA. In the documents about the FAA failures on 9/11, I came across the name of a Monty R. Belger, acting deputy administrator of the FAA at the time. A long-term FAA official who began his career with the FAA in Chicago, Belger was the senior official who oversaw the upgrading of the FAA air traffic computer systems that began in the late 1990s and which was ongoing in 2001. Belger, as acting deputy administrator for air traffic services and system operations, was the key man at the FAA making the executive decisions about these computer upgrades, as the New York Times of June 7, 2001 reported. Quote, "The aviation agency is installing a computer system that controllers can use to determine whether airplanes can depart from established traffic lanes and fly long distances, and whether they will conflict with other airplanes by doing so." Close quote. Belger was the key decision maker at the Federal Aviation Administration, responsible for the software and computer upgrades that involved PTEC, the suspicious upgrades which were being done prior to 9/11. Documents and reports from the MITRE Center for Advanced Aviation System Development in McLean, Virginia, show that PTEC was working with MITRE on FAA computer systems. As his online biography says, Belger, a 30-year veteran of the FAA, was acting deputy administrator for the FAA for 5 years from 1997 to 2002, leading the 49,000-person team and in charge of operating the world's safest aviation system. During his tenure with the FAA, Belger was the associate administrator for air traffic services, responsible for day-to-day operations of the nation's airspace system, and supervised the FAA's modernization plan aimed at improving aviation capacity, safety, and service to airlines. Belger played a pivotal role in assisting in the transition of aviation security responsibilities from the FAA to the new Transportation Security Administration, and he co-chaired the FAA's successful efforts to adopt acquisition and personnel reform. Belger retired from the FAA in September 2002. U.S. Aviation Technology, LLC. After he left the FAA, Belger became the vice president, government connection, of a small Israeli-run company based in the Fort Lauderdale area called U.S. Aviation Technology. The company was founded by Ehud Udi Mendelson, who described himself as, quote, "a captain in the prestigious Army Intelligence Unit of the Israel Defense Force." Ehud received his B.S. degree in Business and Economics from the Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv, Israel. He holds a Computer Network Engineer certification from Microsoft and Novell, his webpage said. Company documents and information from the Israel Venture Capital Research Center website also showed Monty Belger of Centerville, Virginia, as a vice president and government connection of U.S. Aviation Technology, LLC. Mendelson, age 51, was chief technology officer of U.S. Aviation Technology, which was apparently based out of his apartment in Parkland, Florida. Mendelson's company promoted a remote control system that allows a ground pilot to monitor and adjust the computer flight systems on aircraft. As his company presentations say, "We put the ground pilot in the cockpit." The software and system promoted by Mendelson is designed to obtain real-time data from the aircraft's computer recorders in order to monitor flight systems and make corrections if necessary. The possibility to remotely hijack a plane with this system is obvious. Mendelson also promoted a flight data animator, which he said gives the ground pilot all of the data and the visuals that the pilot in the aircraft has. In the two online presentations of this equipment, it was stated that corrections could be made by the ground pilot to avoid an accident or situation. The data is sent via satellite to an antenna on the top of the aircraft. This software and equipment allow a remote pilot to fly the aircraft. Mendelson was apparently promoting this software and system before 9/11 and hoped to have it on the market in November 2001, according to a document in his company presentation. I called Monty Belger to ask about his relationship with Ehud Mendelson and his remote control aviation company. I found it very disturbing that a senior administrator with the FAA would be associated with such a business project, especially after 9/11. I reached Belger at his home on Eagle Tavern Lane in Centerville, Virginia, at about 9 a.m. on January 24, 2008, and asked him about his relationship with U.S. Aviation Technology and Ehud Mendelson. He denied knowing or having anything to do with either the man or the company and asked me to call back later to his office at Lockheed Martin Corporation, where he was a vice president responsible for transportation system security. When I called Belger at his office, he put me on speakerphone, he said, in order to try and access the websites where he was named as a vice president of U.S. Aviation Technology. He continued to deny knowing anything about the company or its founder, a member of Israel's Army Intelligence Unit. Peter Gultz of the NTSB. Peter Gultz, the former managing director of the NTSB, the federal agency that investigates air crashes, was also named, along with Monty Belger, as Vice President Corporate Strategy of U.S. Aviation Technology. Gultz, at the NTSB from 1995 until 1999, personally supervised the investigations of TWA Flight 800, Egypt Air 990, the Value Jet crash in Miami, and the mysterious crash of the young John F. Kennedy's plane off the coast of Cape Cod. There are many outstanding questions about what really happened to the aircraft involved in several of the high-profile cases that Gultz was involved in. Peter Gultz, former managing director of the NTSB, also oversaw the seriously flawed TWA 800 and Egypt Air 990 investigations. Prior to being appointed to the NTSB during the Clinton administration, Gultz had been a political advisor in New Hampshire and a lobbyist for gambling interests in Kansas City, but lacked any real expertise in accident investigation. I found nothing in his resume that would make him a suitable candidate to oversee aviation accident investigations. I called Peter Gultz at his home on January 25, 2008, and asked him about his relationship with Ehud Mendelson and U.S. Aviation Technology. Gultz immediately recalled Mendelson, saying that he had been based in Miami, and said he had met with the Israeli captain from Israeli military intelligence two or three times in Washington, D.C. When I asked if his relationship with Mendelson had begun before or after 9/11, Gultz said that he did not remember. He did, however, have a very clear recall what Mendelson's company was all about: real-time access to all the data from the computer system on an aircraft. Gultz said that he had a hard time understanding what was proprietary about Mendelson's U.S. Aviation Technology. He asked me to send him an email with my questions and the scope of my article. In my email, I explained that as he was listed as a vice president of U.S. Aviation Technology on the company's website and on that of Israel Venture Capital, I asked how and when he had gotten involved with Mr. Mendelson. He wrote back on January 26 and asked me to enlighten him a little more on the focus of my work in this matter. It is worth noting that Gilch did not deny being a vice president of the company, but he was not forthcoming with information about his relationship with Ehud Mendelsohn. If Gilch was confused about Mendelsohn's system, he certainly does not show it in his comments that are found on the testimonial page of U.S. Aviation Technology, where he wrote, quote, "I have reviewed your proposed integrated aircraft early warning system and believe it has considerable technical merit. During my years at the National Transportation Safety Board, we were greatly concerned about the increasing complexity of airplane accidents. Advances in safety, ground proximity warning devices, TCAs, etc., have virtually eliminated certain types of accidents and have forced a greater reliance on the flight data recorder. In a number of accidents, particularly those over open water, TWA Flight 800, Egypt Air, Swiss Air, etc., the investigations were seriously hindered until the boxes were recovered. In the tragic events of September 11th, three of the four FDRs were destroyed, so no data or voice recordings were recovered. Your system of real-time downloading of aircraft data meets a very real and pressing problem. Not only is it important from a safety and security standpoint, it also has applicability for navigation and flight management. A robust two-way data pipe from the aircraft to the ground and back could revolutionize the industry. The key to your system is its initial simplicity, relying on tested, almost off-the-shelf components. That your concept is well on the way to securing a patent further strengthens your proposal. I look forward to working with you on this project and believe that with the appropriate backing, it will be successful." Peter Gilch, former NTSB Managing Director. Close quote. Note: after contacting Belger and Gilch, the incriminating web pages were taken down from the internet. This included the removal of the U.S. Aviation Technology documents. A warning message appeared when trying to access these documents. Some links can only be found using the Internet Archive tool, the Wayback Machine.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Now, I'm going to echo a sentiment from about 7 years ago, first aired on the show by the founding producer, Lynn Gehry. I would love to hear from you if this show has been important to you, either via text, or if you're happy for it to be included on air as MP3 audio. Email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. The End of Water as We Know It, with Argonne National Lab scientist Dr. Seth Darling. Here's the conclusion of a one-hour talk by Dr. Seth Darling. In part one, he spoke about water embedded in certain products that export huge amounts of local water via global trade. And he made an interesting connection between energy production and water. In a time of rising water scarcity, he pointed to economic projections that water demand will rise by at least 55% by 2050. In this part, Dr. Seth Darling is turning to science, describing the amazing characteristics of water, as well as its global history. I also included a few of the questions that he answered at the end of his talk. Here is Dr. Seth Darling.
Okay, so you came to hear some science. What is water? H2O, it's the one molecule everybody knows. But maybe there's something you didn't know about water. So this is what the molecule looks like. The O, oxygen, is the red guy in the middle, and the H, the two hydrogens, are on the two sides. What's important about this molecule is the way it's shaped. Those two hydrogen atoms are not in a straight line with the oxygen, with one on each side. They're both on the same side, like Mickey Mouse ears. And that's a really important thing about water, because oxygen likes negative charge more than the hydrogen does. And so the electrons that are flying around that molecule distribute themselves asymmetrically. There's more electrons on one side than on the other side. And so you get something called polarity, where the molecule is more positive over here and more negative over here. And that one aspect of water, the fact that it's polar, controls so many of the things, the interesting and important properties about water. For one thing, that's what allows microwave ovens to work. Microwaves come through and they cause those polar molecules to rotate and vibrate around, and that's what heats up your food. More importantly, water's polarity is what drives proteins to fold. So the proteins that make up you and me and every living thing on Earth are folded up in very complex ways, these big molecules, and all of those folding interactions are mediated by water. If it were not polar, this would not happen. There would be no life. Another strange thing about water's polarity is that it causes solid water, ice, to be less dense than liquid water, water. That is really unusual for a material. There are only a handful of examples of all the materials in the world that we know of where this is true, and water is one of them. That's why ice floats in your glass of water, because it's less dense than the water. And the same thing happens on Lake Michigan in the winter. This is important, that when it freezes in the winter, that ice sits on the top because it's less dense, and that serves as an insulating barrier to keep the entire lake from freezing during the winter, so you can have life in that water year-round. Again, without that, we might not have life on Earth at all. Another thing about water's polarity is that it makes it a fantastic solvent. Polar molecules are really good at dissolving stuff. So you can put all kinds of different things into water, and it'll stay there. And that is also really important for us. There are thousands and thousands, probably millions, of different chemicals inside us, going through all kinds of different chemical reactions all the time inside our cells. And all of them are dissolved in water. That's the solvent. So all of those things need to be dissolved by just one thing. But the fact that it's a great solvent has an unfortunate side effect, which means it's very easy to pollute. It can dissolve the stuff we want, but it also dissolves all kinds of stuff you don't want to stay in the water. Heavy metals, you know, all those micropollutants I was talking about, and plenty of other things. Once they get in the water, they stay in the water. Okay, a good news piece of water is that you can't use up water. The water that's on Earth has been here since long before we were here, and it'll be here long after we're all gone. There are still competing theories about where all the water came from originally on Earth. Extraterrestrial sources are recognized as probably one of the significant original sources, but that all happened way early in our planet's history, and that water just keeps going around through a cycle, right? You learned about this in grade school, where water evaporates, and then it rains down, and it just keeps going through a cycle. So it's the same water. What that means is that every molecule of water in every glass that you drink has at some point in its life been inside an oak tree, been blasted out by a volcano, and it's been urinated by a dinosaur, which sounds gross. What that actually tells you is another important thing about water, which is that no matter how dirty you make it, it can always be cleaned again. So, clean water. What does that mean, to say water is clean? That's actually a really complicated question, because, as I said, you can put all kinds of different things into water. And you might say, well, let's just take it all out, so all that's left is H2O. You don't want that. You don't want to drink that. That's actually poison, pure water. It'll leach out nutrients from your body. point is, you want the water to be the appropriate cleanliness for the application that it's going to be used. If you're going to drink it, you want it to be pretty clean. You don't want viruses or heavy metals or certain things in there. But you do need some minerals to be in there, like I said, so it's actually not unhealthy to drink. There are other things where the water can be dirtier. If you're just going to water your lawn, it doesn't need to be drinking water quality. Or, on the flip side, if you're going to manufacture semiconductors, like what's inside your smartphones and laptops and all that, you do need that water to be ultra, ultra clean, cleaner than drinking water. In fact, much cleaner than drinking water. So, in fact, the most state-of-the-art water purification plants in the world are at semiconductor manufacturing. So the idea here is you make the right water for the right purpose. It's called fit for use. And again, the ancient Romans did this a long time ago. It's time to start doing it again. So how do you clean water? There are lots of ways to clean water. This is just a few examples. There are more. So one way is you can do media filtration. This is an old school technique. You basically have a big barrel of sand, and you just pour your dirty water over the top and let it come out the bottom. And it's not the sand per se that's doing the cleaning. On the sand grows a biofilm with lots of little bacteria and stuff in it that chew up all the, not all, but a lot of the bad stuff that's in the water. So as it percolates through, it gets cleaned up. What happens in most of our municipal plants is coagulation, flocculation, sedimentation, filtration, which I won't go through the time to describe what that whole process is, but that's how most of our municipal water gets cleaned. Under your kitchen sink, you might have membrane filtration. And in fact, that's an area where most of the exciting research, at least in my view, in water technology is these days, is in membrane filtration. I think there are great opportunities to push that technology forward. Other techniques that are out there are things like distillation. This is where you basically boil the water and then recondense it, and then it comes out much cleaner than it was before and leaves behind all the impurities. And you can also disinfect water just to get rid of the pathogens. You can do that with chlorination, dumping in chlorine. That's what we do in most of our municipal systems. You can also do it with ultraviolet light, which in some places in the developing world is also used in municipal water treatment systems. This brings me back to the issue of our oceans. I told you we don't have a water shortage. It's just that most of it is in the oceans. So we do know how to take seawater and make fresh water. It's a process called desalination, and it's come a long way. People have gotten pretty good at desalination. But I want to give you a sense for the scale of the problem here. Every year, the capacity grows. We're building more and more desalination plants, so that's great. And it's maybe not surprising the countries that are leading the way here are places like Israel and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and places that are near salt water and are very dry. But let me tell you the scale of the problem here. You can see how far we have to go if we're going to try and use this to solve our problem. That's not going to get us out of this mess anytime soon. An awful long way to go. Okay. So, you may not realize, but here in Chicagoland, we actually have a long history of very impressive water engineering. Long time ago, if you walked out on the streets of Chicago, back in the 1800s, it was a really gross place to be. There was sewage on the streets, horse manure and so on, just, it was awful. And, you know, for a city aspiring to be a growing metropolitan center, that was not acceptable. So the idea would be water sanitation. You want to put that sewage into sewer lines instead of just out on the street. The problem with Chicago is that because of the soil conditions, you couldn't dig under the buildings and put in sewer lines. It wasn't feasible. So what did Ellis Chesbro do? He thought, well, I'm going to give Chicago the first sewer system in the United States. No city had it before this. And crazy thought, he said, all right, we can't go under the city, let's lift up the city. And that's actually what they did. They put jacks under all the buildings and jacked them up and built the sewers underneath. Unbelievable, but they did it and it worked. That solved one problem because now the sewage wasn't on the streets anymore. But you know where those sewers dumped? Into the Chicago River. Where did the Chicago River go? Into Lake Michigan. That's where our drinking water was coming from, still is coming from. So we were just dumping raw sewage into our drinking water, and people started getting sick. So you might think, well, let's just dump our sewage somewhere else, but no, not in Chicago. They said, we're just going to make the Chicago River go the other way. And that's what they did. They actually came in and reversed the flow of the Chicago River, dumped a lot of that nasty stuff into what's now the Sanitarian Ship Canal, which actually runs right by Argonne National Laboratory, and, you know, solved the problem, so to speak. But our great water engineering didn't stop there. There's a more recent example at an even larger scale, I would say. So we have this other problem in Chicago that our sewer system is called a combined system, where we use the same lines to handle what comes out of our house as waste and what goes down the storm drains. So for those who've lived in Chicago a long time, you're familiar with when there's a big storm, you get too much water going into that system for the treatment plant to handle, and the whole thing backs up, and it comes up in your basement as untreated sewage. So enough taxpayers finally got fed up with this that they created what you've probably heard of as the deep tunnel, although maybe you've never seen pictures of it. The official name for it is the Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, or TARP plan. But there's this network of tunnels that are massive. And there's a whole bunch of these things under our city which handle this massive flow when there's a big storm that the treatment plant can't handle as fast as it's coming in. And they all those tunnels then dump out into places like this. This is Thornton Quarry. This is the largest such reservoir in the world, I believe. So all that water gets tunneled down, dumped into there, and it'll sit there until the treatment plants can catch up and process all that mess and get you back to the normal state of affairs. So we've been thinking about big-scale water engineering in Chicago essentially as long as there's been a Chicago. Let me bring it home a little more, though, to Argonne. There is a sizable but rapidly growing program in water research at Argonne, which very much is in partnership with the University of Chicago, in fact, principally through the Institute for Molecular Engineering, which is a joint institute between these two great research organizations. So just a few examples of the sort of types of work that are going on in water. One would be, I told you a little earlier about how important policy is, things like virtual water not being policed really at all today. The policymakers need to have the right information to understand what policies to put into place, and that's something that smart scientists and engineers can provide. We're also looking at connections between water and the environment in many ways, and food. So top three challenges we face as a society are energy, water, and food. And they're all connected with each other. It's not just a water-energy nexus, it's a water-energy-food nexus. So you guys answered correctly about where most of our water is used, not withdrawn. Most of it's withdrawn for the power plants, but most of it is used for agriculture. If you're going to try and save some water, that's a good place to turn. And we're not very smart about the way we water our crops. We basically just dump water across an entire farm, more or less the same. What you can do instead is something called site-specific crop management, or precision agriculture, where you go in and you deliver just the right amount of water to even each plant, and just at the right spot by its roots. The Israelis are really good at this already. Another interesting topic of research at Argonne is groundwater dating. So I told you earlier about groundwater and fossil water and how a lot of it's been down there for a really long time. How do you know how long that water's been down there to know how quickly an aquifer is getting replenished? It's actually a really hard question to answer. So the way that we're trained in school that you date old things is carbon dating, right? That's what's used for old human artifacts. Carbon dating doesn't work for things that are hundreds of thousands or even millions of years old. You need some other technique. And so at Argonne, they've developed something called atom trap trace analysis to use krypton dating, and they've actually gone and started dating different aquifers, and they can tell you this one is, 600,000 years old, and that one is 200,000 years old. Really important information. We're also developing all kinds of advanced materials technologies to tackle problems of pollution. In my own group, we're doing things to, for example, clean up oil spills with some advanced materials, and developing, I told you, membranes are where most of the exciting new water technology is coming. We're developing all kinds of advanced membrane technologies at Argonne that clean themselves and effectively filter out pathogens and all kinds of other things. Okay, so we face a lot of huge societal challenges. There's climate change, there's income inequality in our financial system, and so on and so forth. A lot of these big challenges, it's really hard to muster affection for them. The financial system, maybe the University of Chicago is the wrong place to say this, but it's really hard to muster affection about the financial system. But our affection for water is something that we're born with. We are all so connected to water, people love water. It is who we are, literally. And water's invisibility, I said, is bad for us and for water. The fact that we have this innate affection for it is good for us and for water. And we need to start reevaluating water's importance. It's important for our foreign policy, our food, the environment around us, public health, our national security, and as I told you, it's intimately connected to energy. It connects to our lives in so many different ways. So water may be invisible, but I would encourage you to start seeing water. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I was aware of the technology of desalination, but I'm concerned. How is that economically feasible? And what do you think about the future to make it more economically feasible for poor countries in Africa and South Asia?
Okay. Desalination. I mentioned one thing is that we've got a long way to go with it in terms of scale, right? So it's very important in places like Israel, for example, but globally, the scale is essentially irrelevant at this point. So let me talk about technology and science first with desalination. So you can calculate by just the laws of physics, thermodynamics, how much energy it takes to take the salt out of seawater to give you drinking water. It's some amount of energy. And it used to be, you know, a few decades ago, that the desalination technology was a long way away from that limit. When they would use, there are still plants operating in places like Saudi Arabia that essentially do distillation. It's very energy intensive. But the state-of-the-art plants, reverse osmosis plants, which is what people are building today, are so good that they're actually approaching those fundamental limits and how efficient it could ever be. So there's actually no breakthrough coming in, you know, energy savings for desalination. And by the way, that is what limits how much you can desalinate. You talk about the cost. That's where the cost is primarily, is in the energy to build up the pressure to shove the salt water through those membranes and get the salt out. And energy just costs money. So there's no breakthrough coming there. It's never going to get a lot cheaper than it is today. It'll get a little bit cheaper as people get a little better at it, but there's no breakthrough there. What I just said is true for seawater, but the story changes for brackish water, which is less salty water. And there's a lot of brackish water on Earth in aquifers, for example. Many places where there's fossil fuels, there's also water, but the water's a little salty. Not as salty as seawater, but it's too salty to drink. And desalinating that, there's all kinds of exciting technological innovations that are yet to be made. There's all kinds of room for improvement there. So don't give up on desalination altogether. I'm just saying there's not a breakthrough in seawater desalination. In terms of cost, the Israelis pay more for water than we do because it's expensive to desalinate because of the energy. And there's really no way around that. What I would argue, though, is we're not actually paying as much for water here as we should be. There's not really intelligent water pricing much of anywhere on Earth today, which I tried to allude to a few times. That will help us start making smarter decisions with how we use water if it has an appropriate price on it. The flip side of that is you can argue that water is a human right. You can't charge people for water if they can't afford to buy enough to live. That's inhuman. And so how do you balance those two things? And there's another issue. So, you know, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, University of Chicago, we can talk about this, that, you know, uses market forces to try and solve your problem. So you come up with a price, and you say that's the price, and then let the market solve your problem. But all that does is make sure that we humans share our water in a certain way that maybe makes sense. The problem is we're not the only ones who need water. The ecosystem around us needs water, too. The rest of the Earth needs a lot of water to grow the trees and all the other things that happen on Earth that need water, all the other organisms. And they don't pay water bills. So there has to be another hand that comes in with Adam Smith's invisible hand, a green hand, if you will, that represents the, you know, the Lorax, speaks for the trees.
You had fracking in your discussion. Can you address two issues here? One, you're talking about a shortage of water. My understanding of fracking is you're taking water, polluting it, dumping it down into the ground, therefore making our short supply of water even less.
Yep.
Second, what about fracking? What do you see is the probability that some of this water going down into the fracking area is going to contaminate the groundwater that you're talking about?
So people are just starting to study that, and I think there are mixed reports. I suspect it totally depends on the local geology, what the answer to that question is. I think there are places where it doesn't end up getting into the aquifers, and there are places where it does. And so we just need to be a lot smarter and figure that all out before we start doing all those operations, which we're not doing today. And you're right, those types of operations in general, fossil fuel operations, are very water intensive. And also they produce a lot of water. It's called produced and flowback water that comes back up with the fossil fuels, and that water is dirty. It's got salt and hydrocarbons and heavy metals and other junk in it that was down there under the ground. And you know, what do you do with all that water? And right now what they're usually doing is they're just dumping it into a holding pond in many cases, which are not even lined, and so then it just goes back down and might get into aquifers. So, yeah, there's all kinds of challenges there that are going to need to be addressed.
You talked a little bit about climate change, its impact on water. Is there any way to really quantify how much of an impact climate change could have on the cost of water?
Okay, I don't think the cost of water is ever going to go down, and probably nor should it. Quantify the effect is a really hard thing to do, and especially because there's so many ways in which, you know, climate and water are interrelated. I mentioned drought. I mentioned melting of glaciers. Also, sea level rise is pushing salt water into freshwater aquifers, so it's polluting those sources. Precipitation changes, extreme weather events are changing the way we interact with water. There are countless examples of interconnections between climate disruption and water, none of which I can think of that are good.
I have a question that goes back to the idea that we live next to this great body of fresh water. I've also seen maps that show that the aquifers and the groundwater depletion in the Chicago and Milwaukee region is something like 900 feet, which is greater than some areas of the Southwest. So is it almost like a false sense of security that we have the lake next to us if what we're doing is we're depleting the groundwater to that extent?
Yeah, it's true the water table is falling almost everywhere. And so, you know, when people drill wells, they have to keep drilling them deeper and deeper because that groundwater just keeps getting lower and lower as it gets drained. And yes, that is true in places where there's a lot of surface water too, like here in the upper Midwest, but it's especially true in places where that's the primary source of water and it's just disappearing frighteningly fast. So yes, we need to take responsibility for our water use, even though we are comparatively water rich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Darling. As a nanoscientist, according to your biographical information, are there any revolutionary molecular nano-level prospects that you are working on?
So one example, pathogens in water are a huge problem. That's why every 90 seconds a child dies somewhere in the world. The way that we get rid of pathogens today is usually by dumping chlorine in the water. And that causes all kinds of problems. One of the things it causes is it creates other toxic compounds, which we go through a lot of troubles in our water systems to try and take care of, because that chlorine reacts with various organic compounds and creates all kinds of nasty carcinogenic junk. It's also, chlorinated water can't be put through a reverse osmosis system. It damages the membranes, so you have to take out the chlorine and then put it back in later in the system. So it's not a good solution, and it's not a solution that's available anyway in many parts of the developing world. What would be nice is if you could just filter out those pathogens. Now, we have filters that can do that, like a reverse osmosis filter. A reverse osmosis filter is basically non-porous. Think of it as just a sheet of plastic. And you shove the heck out of the water, it'll go through there, and nothing else except the water will go through there. And so that'll work, but you need an enormous amount of energy to do that. It's overkill to remove pathogens, which are much bigger than something like salt ions, which is what reverse osmosis is, you know, really good at taking out. What you'd like is a filter that had pores in it that were just a little bit smaller than maybe those viruses or cryptosporidium or whatever your parasite or pathogen is, so that it can't go through, but the water can easily go through those comparatively. For a water molecule, a pore like that would be huge. Okay. Those filters are called ultrafiltration or nanofiltration filters. That's sort of the length scale of things like viruses. They're kind of tens of nanometers in scale. There are no good commercial ultrafiltration membranes to filter out all of the pathogens. What you really want is a membrane where all the pores are the same size and just the right size so that you can easily push water through and you filter out all the pathogens. We are trying to do that using a technique called self-assembly. There are these polymers that organize themselves into structures that are right on that length scale. You can try and build membranes out of those things. We use other technology we've developed at Argonne to make those things be chemically inert and thermally stable and all the other things mechanically robust that you want in a membrane so that we can effectively filter out pathogens.
You mentioned every 90 seconds a child dies because of not having access to clean drinkable water. And you also mentioned that having access to clean water is a human right. I noticed you mentioned the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One portion of it is because of water. What are your thoughts on Israel cutting off the water supply to the Palestinians, and how is this in compliance with human rights and international law?
Yeah, so we're, again, stepping well outside my area of expertise. A general statement, not to that particular geopolitical situation, is that I do believe water on some level is a human right. This is why we can't just simply throw a price on water and expect that to solve everything, because there are plenty of people living in poverty who just wouldn't be able to afford to live. Everybody needs water. It's one of those few things that you just cannot live without. And so it should not be used as a weapon of war, which, by the way, water has been used as a weapon since humans have been around. You know, sieges on ancient castles, they would dump poisonous stuff into the river that was going into the castle, things like that. I mean, water's been used in war as long as there have been humans. Humans are just awful to each other, and water's so important. If you're going to try and hurt people, that's an effective way to hurt people, which we shouldn't do. Sorry, I think we'll need to stop.
You heard the end of a one-hour talk with Q&A by Dr. Seth Darling, entitled The End of Water as We Know It. Seth Darling is a scientist at Argonne National Lab and a fellow at the Institute for Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago. He's the co-author with Douglas Sisterson of the 2014 book, How to Change Minds About Our Changing Climate. He spoke at the International House, University of Chicago, and was recorded by Dale Lehman on May 18, 2016. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. We're going to have Ann Garrison a little later to talk about the Green Party because, as you know, Bernie has hit the wall, or the off-ramp. We haven't decided our metaphor. he's going to have to decide what to do. And so in the presidential elections, we often forget other parties with ideas similar to those of Bernie Sanders, who inspired, millions of people. And it really isn't – the Bernie story is far from over. And the Green Party, we're going to talk to Ann Garrison about Jill Stein. Jill Stein and others are sympathetic to the Sanders campaign. Their work basically complements it. And so – the Bernie Sanders, as far as we know, intends to take the campaign all the way to the convention, and that is where why very powerful newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times and others are saying we'd rather he didn't do that because, of course, there is a platform issue. That is, what is that party about and what does it stand for? And the people who supported Sanders and who are his delegates – real live elected delegates want to be there. They want to be heard. And indeed, there may actually still be an issue of who is the nominee. There's state of California that has some shocking electoral issues to tell us about. There are And my understanding, looking at the LA Times and others, it might be as many as 500,000 votes as yet uncounted in the California primary. So it's something we need to know a lot about. And we're going to keep following it on the Taylor Report. And we will be talking to Ann Garrison, who lives in the Bay Area. She's been on the show previous. You know, everybody knows she's an authority on matters to do with Africa, and also very active in Berkeley and San Francisco, Oakland, and that region, and is a Green Party supporter. So we'll be talking to her about what the Green Party is saying and doing at this moment. And also in probably 10, 15 minutes, we're going to be talking to Norman Otis Richmond, quite a well-known figure in Toronto. He is a widely respected writer, and he's self-described accurately as a bluesologist. And he, like myself and many listeners of the show, were quite interested in the knowing how the final send-off, the funeral of Muhammad Ali. There's nothing that happened with Muhammad Ali that didn't have connotations, broad social connotations. So the funeral is being studied, and people are commenting on who spoke, who did not speak, and what was said and what was not said. So we'll be going over that. Of course, we're going to also review Muhammad Ali's career and look and highlight some matters that are not topically taken up. I'll just say about that, by the way, as a lead-in for Norman. I am particularly interested in the collapse of journalism around the Muhammad Ali event. We were all told when his death was announced last Friday, or Thursday night, that Muhammad Ali had worked out with friends and family a special funeral service and arrangement, and we saw interviews with his spokesperson, and I'm talking about mainstream reporting told us that for 9 years they had worked on this, and that Muhammad Ali had initialed and read each of the pages, and the funeral plans were at least two inches thick. And therefore, when we read or heard that there was going to be two leaders of states attending the funeral, namely the King of Jordan and the President of Turkey, were going to be in attendance at the funeral of Muhammad Ali, well, there was a ripple of interest, to say the least. And further, they were going to be speaking. We were told that the King of Jordan and the President of Turkey were going to say something. And that was the story for about a day, 2 days, maybe three. Then we were told something really interesting, that the King of Jordan and the President of Turkey would not be speaking. And then we were told they graciously accepted that. And the word in the Washington Post was they had been bumped, B-U-M-P-E-D, bumped, in favor of two other speakers, and who were at that point unnamed. So I'm ready and waiting for all my big league newspapers and CNN and others to tell me, well, what is this about? Because you have already told me that for 10 years, Muhammad Ali had planned his own funeral, and that everything, and I have the New York Times headline from Saturday, or actually, no, it is, it. Yes, it was on the weekend. Anyway, the New York Times headline said that it was a great event as scripted by Muhammad Ali himself. Well, did he script that he wanted the President of Turkey? He wanted the king? If he did, did he come back from death and replace them. And when he did that, after having died, did he replace him with two as yet unnamed people who would be added on the day of the funeral? Well, the Times hasn't helped me out with that, and nor the Washington Post, nor anybody. And if you look it up, you won't even know whether or not the King of Jordan attended. I'm going to go with a wild guess that he did not. But I'm to accept the words of a spokesperson that he graciously, that all this was done graciously. Now, what happened with the president of Turkey wasn't gracious. The president of Turkey came to the United States. He was in Louisville, and he attended the Thursday service, the Islamic service for Muhammad Ali. That was Thursday. There, he, of course, did not speak. Incidentally, he had with him the highest-ranking clergy person who he had hoped would have an opportunity to recite a prayer. That was not permitted. The moment the service was over on Thursday, he then departed, and not without the kind of thing we've grown to accustom with the president of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan. This, again, remember, we're talking about a major U.S. ally, a major part of piece of NATO, and a state that is at the moment politically and morally and every other way compromised because it is pouring terrorists across its border illegally into Syria so that they can kill and maim Syrians. And this is permitted and excused and not noted by the U.S. State Department. Certainly, if you're asking about the Canadian government, relax. They're sound asleep, and they know it's none of their business, so they don't say a word. But this is what Mr. Erdogan is doing. In the middle of this, he gets invited to come to the most famous American in the world, not George Washington, or even Bill Clinton, but Muhammad Ali, who's actually known around the world. Now he comes to Louisville, and in the funeral, after the funeral, he is exiting, and you can go on YouTube, thank you YouTube or internet, and you will watch his security guys get into a shoving match with the FBI, and it's the old thing: if you have two armed security groups, the first thing that's likely to happen is they'll fight each other. They're there to protect one guy, and they will kill each other. Because if you are given the job and you're elite commando, you can swim underwater for 5 minutes, all that stuff, you're ready. They put you at the door of the president. That's yours, and you're to do or die to keep that door. So the FBI guy positioned himself at the car door. So along comes the Turkish equivalent FBI, and he says, "Move." And the other guy says, "No, I'm not moving. It wasn't my job." So then you get to watch powerful people stand around making ugly faces at each other and calling their bosses and saying, "We better do something because somebody's going to get hurt." Anyway, that is the president of Turkey. Now, by the way, why isn't that called what it used to be called, the diplomatic scandal? Because this all comes under the purview of what the Secretary of State. If the Secretary of State, Mr. Kerry, you're listening, you don't know how to run anything. For sheer embarrassing incompetence. If a head of state comes, he is, whether you like it or not, or she, there are protocols, and you observe them. This is not some guy from down the street. This is not the mayor of a town in Carolina. This is the head of a government. He's a member of NATO. It's kind of important. And so the protocols are all worked out, and everything goes smooth. But this did not go smooth. Anyway, going back to Muhammad Ali, is that what he wanted? I think somebody better tell us. They said we were going to see the two-inch book of funeral arrangements as annotated and noted and initialed by the champ himself. So I'm curious, why did he want – this will be the big question of the day. Why in the world did he want the King of Jordan? The King of Jordan isn't one of his favorite people. And why did he want the president of Turkey? Again, there's no pictures that I know of the two of them together. It's a very curious embarrassing. But my main criticism is that we don't have any journalists who are telling us about any of this, because we're all supposed to – this is Disneyland and you had a good time. This is not real live events involving heads of state and whether or not you even have a competent State Department that can arrange to bring in high-powered visitors for an event of this magnitude. As I say, no scandal, no nothing, everybody just looking away. But frankly, the champ was what they call a world champ. And so around the world, this is followed closely. He's the only American most of the people in the world care anything about. If he showed up in China, people ran to see him. If he showed up in Ghana, people ran to see him. If he showed up in Kenya, this is notorious. Wherever he went, he was loved because he was seen as the nice American. He liked to hug the leaders of foreign states, and he encouraged a thing that's an old word called peaceful coexistence. He urged states to get along and the states be mutually respectful. In this sense, he's very un-American because we now have a country that considers itself exceptional, so it can treat the president of Turkey like he's a mayor from South Carolina, and they can treat the king of Jordan like, well, we'll call you if we need you, which is pretty much seems to be how it went. Anyhow, those are all my questions. We're going to get to that a little later when we talk with Otis. I'll say on the matter of Orlando, Florida, and what happened there, this man, Omar Mateem, had an AR-15 assault rifle, and those things are man killers. That's what they're for, and it's an ugly, dangerous weapon. And it was used. This weapon was used at Sandy Hook. It was used in San Bernardino. It was used in the Aurora shooting. All these mass murders and the other places where you see these big numbers, the weapon is an AR-15 assault rifle. And the reason Americans say they can have that is the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment says that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state. So, and I want to tell you something. The murderer at Sandy Hook and the murderer in Orlando are not members of well-regulated militias. So I think I put my finger on a problem. Americans are illiterate. They can't read. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. None of these killers with their AR-15 are members of well-regulated militias. If they were in well-regulated militias, they wouldn't be allowed to have it. When I was in the Marine Corps, we did not take our weapons home at night. You couldn't do it. That weapon had to be stored, locked, and it had to be accounted for. You didn't get to keep it. You had to be – that's being well-regulated. So this kind of madness – where people are afraid to even take on the simple subject of the Second Amendment and understand it because of the political fallout from, you know, I tell you, part of it is intimidation. It's hard to argue with people who are carrying those damn things. You know, you say, well, you shouldn't have it, and you say to yourself, and I suppose he gets mad that I said that. That's where we are. We have, and incidentally, they have all these police with their tanks and their all this SWAT stuff. They didn't want to go in there. It took them 3.5 hours to get to take this guy out because, you know, when the sergeant says, okay, Frankie, get in there, Frankie says to himself, that sucker's got an AR-15. I ain't going in. I'm not – my mama didn't raise a dummy. And so people say, well, yeah, but people are being killed. Yeah. Well, see, that's the problem. Anyhow, there's a lot more to be said. I would point out an additional thing. Yes, he is from Afghanistan, his father. His father is a big Taliban supporter, has his own TV or YouTube shouting point. And and we forget who the Taliban is. I remember watching Dan Rather, CBS News, running around a hill saying, oh, the Taliban, oh, they're great guys, because they're fighting the Russians. And they were great. They were heroic. And then later they started to fight us. And I haven't heard from Dan about that, but he told us they were freedom fighters. Apparently, they didn't want to be in Afghanistan. They liked to live in Florida and elsewhere. And the U.S. has romanced those guys and told us they were terrific and brilliant and that they were freedom lovers, which was a lie the first time it was ever said. This Osama bin Laden was one of these people. So the U.S. has to decide, is going to fight terrorism or not? Syria says, let's fight terrorism together. Russia says, let's fight it together. The U.S. always said, no, we don't want to be with you. Well, in other words, you want your own terrorists, and then he can have his terrorists. So let us be serious. You're not fighting terrorism. Anyway, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to speak in a few moments with Norman Otis Richmond.